Okay, I just got the nod from our AGP folks that we can begin the meeting. Welcome, everyone. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2015. This is a special meeting at the Moore Bay Veterans Hall. It's 4:30 p.m. We're located at 209 Surf Street here in Moore Bay. For the record, all council members are present, and we do have a quorum. And for today's discussion, we are discussing our 10-year budget forecast. This is a study session for that. We will start it off with our staff report. Our city manager and consultant will be conducting that. As we go through the items, I think we'll have some questions back and forth. We'll conclude with some questions at the end of that, and then following that presentation and questions from council, we'll open it up for public comment and then come back to council for discussion. That sound pretty good?
Great.
Good. All right. So with that, we'll turn it over to Mr. Buckingham and get us kicked off on the
Great, thanks. So just by way of introduction first, this is Mr. Bob Leyland from Management Partners.
Welcome, Bob.
He's the financial guru at Management Partners. There's other gurus there, but he's the financial one. And speaking of that, as you know, this council and the city contracted with Management Partners to provide us a deep and broad look at the entire city structure, operations, and finances. Did that last fall. They are partway through the process. They are all the way through the financial part of the process, or pretty much all the way. And so really this is part one tonight of the overall Management Partners feedback. So we wanted to front load the financial piece so that we had it in hand and in mind as we go into budget season. The other half of it, which perhaps is the management analysis piece, looking at organization, at different spending lines, at potential revenue lines. Really what I wasn't here, but from my perspective, probably got the most interest in the last Management Partners study. That piece is ongoing, and Amy Paul and the rest of the Management Partners team are working hard on that. We've sent them back a couple of times with additional things to look at, additional things to dig out, and so I'd anticipate maybe late this month, but probably more into May, because there's no reason to rush that. We really want an A-plus job on that, and we've gone back and asked them to benchmark some things against similar cities. So really what I want to communicate here is this is part one of what the city's getting out of our Management Partners review, and in part two we'll come back to when the rest of the team has finished that. So and the mayor just discussed the process, so I'm going to turn it over to Bob here in a moment. He'll sort of pitch each of these slides. I'll probably make a couple of comments on several of them, and then turn it over to the council to ask specific questions about the slide at hand or the situation at hand. And if it is something that's coming up in a later slide, later in the presentation, we might say, hey, we're going to cover that in three slides, which hopefully you'll say, okay, great, let's wait for three slides. Or you can say, no, go there now and throw us completely off. And then once we're sort of complete on each slide and everybody thinks they have their answers, we'll go on to the next one. Then at the end of the presentation, as the mayor said, any other general counsel questions, probably open it for public comment. And then that's probably when I would recommend we actually have Bob's got a dashboard, a budget dashboard, an interactive, predictive, really cool spreadsheet where we can sort of play around with numbers and look at what those changes do to our budget situation in the 10 out years. So Mayor, you can decide if we want to do that just before public comment or just after. But it would be worthwhile, I think, I'm sure that several of our council members would love to sort of tweak those numbers and see what happens if we increase revenue $100,000 and decrease cost $200,000. Or what happens if we changed our general fund reserve level from a percentage rate to a flat rate? Some different things like that. So there's sort of an interactive piece that we can do that on. Okay, so before I turn it over to Bob, the primary purpose of tonight is to get, for all of us in the room, this is a file and receive report, but it's file and receive in the absolute top level of our consciousness so that we all realize how close to the edge of insolvency we are. And therefore, and I didn't say we're over the edge of insolvency. We want to be realistic, neither conservative nor liberal, but realistic. but to realize how close we are on the edge in some of our financial things, so that as we approach future decisions, the budget and other decisions that will be coming before the council that have something to do with revenues or expenditures, that this is top in our mind, so we have this in our mind as we look at those future decisions. So with that, I'll turn over to Bob, and we'll start walking through this.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Mr. Mayor, council members, I'm Bob. In my prior life, back in the 70s, I was with the Assembly Revenue and Tax Committee when we implemented Proposition 13 in the late 70s. Subsequent to that, I worked for the City of Sacramento as their assistant director and was director of finance in Fairfield for 26 years. Following that, I've been consulting and spending most of my time the last few years on the Stockton and San Bernardino bankruptcies, which our firm is involved helping the cities there. So I have seen small cities and big cities and cities that are really in trouble and cities that just need to watch things carefully. You're more in the latter category, believe me. I've seen some that are in bad shape. But what we're going to do tonight, as Dave pointed out, we have a comprehensive report coming from our firm, and my part of that report will be the general fund forecast, and it will be incorporated with the report that you get later. But we're going to do a slideshow tonight that walks you through the budget model we've created for the city, and this is something that we'll leave with you and you can use in future years to help your planning process, take a look at the impact of alternative economic conditions and policy decisions, and track your progress towards moving towards fiscal sustainability. So we're going to start off with a discussion of the resources of the general fund, because it's really important to get a good grasp about the money you can expect to be available to spend, and then take a look at the cost drivers that are looking to absorb those resources, then look at the fund balance, the interaction with your reserves, and see what the implications are for the long term. So the reasons to do a long-term forecast. First of all, it's a critical element of that is that the assumptions are transparent. Everybody knows what you're dealing with. You have a discussion of where you think revenues will increase, what the assumptions are for costs, and it's all laid out so nobody can quibble about it. You can say, what if this number is higher, that number is lower? You can play that out. The model will give you an answer right off the bat. It also provides a disciplined approach to avoid wishful thinking that revenue growth will bail you out. There's too many cities that have the approach that, well, hope springs eternal, revenues will be higher, that'll take care of our situation. What we have striven to do in this report is come up with what we feel are realistic numbers based on outside opinion, where we can get it from your sales, property tax consultants, taking a look at what other cities have found to be successful approaches for forecasting their revenues. A long-term forecast avoids the peril of short-term focus. If you're just looking at a budget year by year, you don't have any idea of the downstream implications of changes in the economy or decisions that are going on locally, or policy decisions you yourself make with bargaining units. So this way, you see that whole story played out, and as you are making the decisions or considering the options, you can run scenarios through this model and give you an idea of what the implications of that will be. I think it'll be a good fiscal tool to use for these future years. It'll help guide the budget process and give you a much better foundation.
Let me just make a comment on the second bullet here and then see if there's any questions from the council at this point. But so really what you're going to see, this forecast is based on where we are now as a city, not on a dream. And we could compare that to the decision that we all made on water rates and potential redevelopment of the Atascadero Road site. And what we said is we're not going to bet on future revenue there when it comes to the water rates. And so what this forecast does, it doesn't bet on an economic super redevelopment. It doesn't bet on a redevelopment of Dynegy, on a Tri-W site, anything. It forecasts based on what we are now and then a realistic view of what we should expect, could reasonably expect revenues to do, not based on significant change or growth, but based on normal processes. And you'll see that a projected 3% growth in TOT over time, same with sales tax, but not a big bump based on some major redevelopment win. Mm-hmm. Any counsels from the question at this point?
Yes, thanks. I do have one, because sure. I can tell that this tool is going to be very valuable for us, and looking forward to getting into that and reading the report. I already see some really interesting information. What I'm wondering is, will this be retained by the city, so as we go forward in the years, we'll be able to utilize this same dynamic and actually implement this tool on our own to
yes.
update it and so forth?
Right. Susan is going to be the keeper of the model, and as you get updates in data, you can roll that in to the model and just extend years on the end, and year after year, you can keep looking 10 years down the line. Yeah. All right, so let's start with revenues. The general fund has three major revenue sources, so you have a lot of eggs in just a limited number of baskets. The property tax, almost 30% of the total, and that's the normal property tax plus the vehicle license fee shift that has been made part of the property tax, that amount that you receive from the county. Sales tax, 15%, and TOT, 24%. That's a lot of reliance on the TO tax. You don't see that except in smaller tourist-oriented towns. And you match that description. And so that's both a blessing and a curse. And we're going to go through each of these top three sources in more detail. So we will be talking about the TOT and the implications of that for the city. But basically, $12 million in revenue, three big sources. And so as those three sources go, so goes your general fund. Now, let's talk about something else, and that's recession. If you're looking at a budget 1 year at a time, you might always say, recession, that'll be longer than 1 year into the future. But when you're looking at a 10-year period, there's going to be a recession, and here's why. Since 1928, at the national level, under the official periods of U.S. recession, these blue bars on this calendar show where they have been, and they have averaged every 6.5 years. Now, they haven't been like the Great Recession that we just went through, but they have been recessions nonetheless, a couple of quarters of negative growth. And so given that they've occurred every 6.5 years, if you take a look at California just for this latter period, the red line is statewide unemployment rate. Superimposed on the yellow bars are the periods of local economic downturns, so the negative impact on local government revenues during recessions. And, of course, that matches up very well with the unemployment rate. And, again, it's been on a pretty predictable basis. So the Great Recession started at the end of 2007. It ended officially in mid-2009, although it didn't feel like that to anybody. The impact continued to roll a few years into the future, and local government revenues in particular tend to lag. Property tax in particular, there's a whole one-year lag because there's an annual lien date, January 1st, when value is officially set. You miss that lien date, then for a property that's not changing ownership or being newly constructed, it won't change again for another year. Whereas TOT and sales tax are much more immediate. If the economy's bad, you begin to feel that quicker. So when you take a look at this, what it tells us is that it's prudent to assume a modest recession during this forecast period. And what we're assuming is mid-2017. Now, we didn't just pull that out of the hat. There are a number of economic experts that are talking about that loosely as probably the time of the next downturn. The legislative analyst, one of the major sales tax auditing firms, has been talking about that. And so in all of our cities that we're working in right now, that's our assumption, 2017. Now, you can't predict the timing, the duration, or the severity of any given recession in advance. It's just not doable. But what we've done is taken a look at some of the more modest of these past recessions and come up with what we consider to be a comparable impact that can be triggered. And one of the advantages of the model is you can switch the recession on or off, you can switch the year it occurs, you can switch the base magnitude of impact. And so by playing with that, you can test the sensitivity of the model and how viable your economic status looks like through that period. So as we get into each of the revenues, you'll see the recessionary impact on each of those major sources. Anything on the recession before we go on? Okay. All right, let's start on the property. Yes.
One more question. Mm-hmm. Actually, I do. Your comment about the smaller size tourist economy driven towns.
Right.
Do these recessions don't necessarily go hand in hand with the national model or the larger city model? Mm-hmm. So, is there a lag time for these smaller municipalities in terms of recession?
Well, probably the major impact is on disposable income of people who otherwise would be traveling. And so it's when they begin to feel that pinch. So it depends on unemployment, and it depends on, even if you're not unemployed, you might run a business that is suffering because you've got fewer customers, therefore you may feel less inclined to travel. So it's hard to say exactly when that point comes, but when it does come, then there's a question of where you're positioned in the tourist market. And as I'll comment now since we're into it. Higher-end destinations are often the ones that see the worst impact. If you are considered a value destination, some people may come here that might have gone somewhere else, and people that have always come here will come back. And you'll see as we look at some of the individual impacts, the recession hit other cities far harder than it did Morro Bay. And so there are some characteristics to your local economy that have tended to insulate you a little bit, not completely, of course, but you have not been hit as hard. And so the supposition is you won't be hit as hard by the future recessions either. But we'll know that when we get there.
So we'll see, especially in the area of property tax and then TOT and sales tax,
yeah,
that the effect of the recession in Morro Bay was, I don't think we show comparison cities here,
well,
but Bob can attest to it. But you can see just on the raw numbers, the effect was relatively moderate compared to other cities based on the things that Bob was just explaining.
Okay, so we're going to start with the property tax. We'll do about four slides on property tax, sales tax, and TOT, so you have a good sense of where you stand on those. So, as you know, local agencies get a share of the 1% property tax limit set forth by Proposition 13. And the overlapping jurisdictions each get a share of the pie. So for any given home or business in Morro Bay, you've got a school district, you've got the county, you've got the city, perhaps other special districts. On a statewide basis, this is a rough average based on a study a few years ago, cities tend to average about 15% of the property tax generated by a property within their city on average. You're a little under that, 13.065 according to the county for the current year. So you're a little below the statewide average, but the statewide average varies. There's a whole category called low property tax cities, and they're in the single digits. So you're better off than them. But this is a situation you can't change. It is an artifact of how Prop 13 was implemented, and it looked back at the history.
You said you worked on Prop 13, right?
Yeah, I did. At the time, the feeling was that it was best to lock in the situation that people had so that they didn't everybody suffered proportionately relative to where they were. So you go in the Wayback Machine to the 3 years prior to 1978, and that was the determining factor of how these ratios were established.
So we almost didn't show this slide because we can't do anything about
it.
We're stuck right here. There's no way to change it, but I guess there's sort of good news. We're only 2% lower than the state average instead of being a single digit city.
Yeah. And so, again, it gives you kind of a sense of where you stand. Now, let's put Dynergy in context. That is obviously a major planning issue and economic issue for the city, and there's questions about what that parcel may wind up looking like down the line. But you have absorbed pretty much the major hit involved in terms of loss of value. The Dynergy is down to about $17 million, which is 1% of the total, the total assessed value of the city as a whole. And so it's not that great. So that's the good news, I guess. Being only 1% of the $2 billion in assessed value, the forecast assumes continuation of the current value. We don't try to predict what happens at a given point in time, but the model can predict whether at a certain point value goes up or value goes down. The overall economic impact of that parcel is going to depend upon whether it becomes a tax-exempt use, whether it's a use that generates sales tax or other revenues, whether it continues in some form of energy generation. And so that we can make some broad predictors of that. But in terms of property tax, it's actually not a major driver at this point. The rest of the city has eclipsed it.
So two things. One, going back to my sort of initial comments, is this model that you're seeing tonight over 10 years assumes that the value of Dynergy's property is unchanged, essentially, for the duration of this model for 10 years. So we are not banking on the property value going from $17 million up to something else. So, and then just to put this in perspective a little bit more, that $17 million in assessed value provides the city about $22,000 a year. Not very much. Let's say that the Dynergy property was worth 10 times what it is right now, just property value-wise. That's still only $220,000 a year of revenue, which is under 2% of our general fund revenues. So just Dynergy as property value is no panacea for anything. Dynergy redeveloped as something that produces something other in addition to property value, sales tax, TOT, franchise, something else, there's significant value there. But we should be thinking about it that way. Improved property value at Dynergy is a almost negligible improvement to our overall revenues, only from the property tax perspective.
Excuse me, may I interrupt for one moment?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here, Bob. Mm-hmm. If we could go back just for a brief moment to the slide we cannot change. I just did have one question, however.
Sure.
So what about turnover of residences when folks sell and the house then is reassessed?
Correct.
Would that alter this?
It doesn't alter the share you get, but it will. You'll get the same share of a larger value. And actually, the model does take into account estimates of new construction and changes in ownership. You're not heavy into new construction, so that's not the major driver unless there is some big redevelopment that happens.
So, Christine, this is the multiplier against that new value. Mm-hmm. So that's the way to think about it. So if you go forward one slide, actually, and use the Dynergy example. So if Dynergy were to go from the calculation, remember, and it said $22,000 of revenue, that's $17 million times 1% of assessed value times that 13% of the previous slide equals $22,000. So if Dynergy or your home were to change over and double in value, I don't think your home's worth $17 million. But if it were, then that 13% multiple doesn't change. What does change is what that 1%, it's 1% of.
Okay, great. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of revenue per capita, one of the things you'll find in our report is we take a look at some comparison cities, and we've tried to pick more resort-oriented and coastal smaller cities to take a look at. And so in that context, we took a look at property tax revenue per capita. you can see the statewide average is about $100. Morro Bay is 234, so it ranks just below Pismo Beach. So from the standpoint of the tax dollars you're getting per capita, you're getting pretty good generation relative to our comparison cities, and well above the statewide mark. And this statewide mark is for full-service cities with or without libraries, and there's 290 of those. So it's a pretty good comparison.
I'd just like to point out that Bob said Atascadero is a resort city.
Yeah. Well, they're not all resort cities. Some were picked because they were close.
Okay.
So Bob, one question on this.
Yes.
I recognize some of them, but I didn't reference the 2008 Management Partners report. Are these the identical comparisons?
No.
Okay.
No.
Some are, but not all.
Some are.
We re-benchmarked. We spent time with the staff and with Management Partners and took a few out, put a few more in to based on what we thought would be an appropriate cross-section. Some of them you look at and say, well, why in the world like Scotts Valley? Because that's way away from the coast, but it's actually sort of about the same size. It's sort of an isolated community, sort of like Morro Bay is. Doesn't have, you know, not a whole lot of slow folks coming here to do their big box shopping, that sort of thing. So we did re-benchmark some of these cities, but kept some of them.
Okay, great. So now in terms of the historical levels and the forecasted trend, let's take a little look at this. First point to make is that the recession impact from roughly 2010 to 13 was pretty moderate. You see the negatives here. That is about 2% annual loss for 3 years in a row. To put it in context, the city...
Bob, let me just explain the chart. The chart is that the blue line is actual dollars, and the yellow bars are percent increase or decrease from previous year.
Yeah, thank you. So the color of the axis matches up with color. So blue is the actual revenues measured on the left axis, percentage change on the right axis. And so after high growth leading up to the recession, which was true in a lot of places, you had a pretty minor decline. There were some cities that lost 40 or 50% of their property tax. You did not suffer that badly. So a little bit of a downturn here. And then in the last few years, it's picked back up. For 2015 fiscal year, we're projecting slightly higher amount based on more recent information from the county, about almost $3.5 million versus $3.35. This little downturn in 2018 is from a 2017 recession with a one-year lag. And again, we're assuming it not nearly as strong as the Great Recession. Overall, taking all these future years into account, it's about a 2.1% average growth rate. There really is not much in the way of Proposition 8 recovery. Those are parcels whose actual value went down below their Prop 13 restricted value. That's pretty much covered by now, brought back to its Prop 13 level. Not much in the way of new construction, and then the changes in ownership that were mentioned. Those are incorporated. So some years the growth will be in the 3 or 4% range, and we're assuming that when the recession occurs, the amount that was lost will be made up, because that's pretty much been the experience on the property tax side. If you lose revenue in the recession, lose value, that value will come back up, pretty much by definition, because the value is already restricted by Prop 13, so you don't have as far to go as if you were trying to bring it up to what its full true market value was.
So, Matt, that's a great picture of the question you asked. The effect of the Great Recession in Morro Bay was maybe $250,000 of revenue annually.
A little bit of a decline, and then it'll slow a little bit and then come back up.
Which is, in the big picture again, that's about 2% of general fund, so a very modest, actually, effect for the size of that recession on our city.
Yeah, your property tax is remarkably stable compared to a lot of cities we've looked at. Okay, so let's look at sales tax. There is a total rate, and here it is 8%. The city gets directly 0.75% of that, and then 0.25% used to belong to the city. The state took it over, but they are backfilling for that amount. And you've probably heard this reference to the triple flip. It is a portion of the sales tax that is a quarter of the total amount, and the state catches you up at sort of a year in arrears, and that's been going on for 10 years, but it's about to end. Triple flip by fiscal year 17 will have reverted to the city, and then you will be back to the 1% local rate. Then you've got a 0.5% for Measure Q. That tracks with 0.5% local voter-approved taxes in many of your neighboring cities, San Luis Obispo, Arroyo Grande, Pismo Beach, Grover Beach, and Paso Robles. The rest of the tax rate belongs to the state. In terms of numbers of cities and the total rates that apply, Morro Bay is in this big column right here at the 8% level, 155 cities. That's the one with the most individual cities statewide. The other popular rate is 9%, or 127 cities in that. But if you take a look at the 67 that are in the lowest, a few others here, and then the 155 in the 8% range, your total rate is at the 49th percentile statewide. So you're just about in the middle.
One point here, you see the next biggest bar at 8.5%, since one of the things we might consider is another 0.5% for streets. That is the 60th percentile. So essentially right now we are right at the 50th percentile. If our voters were to commit an additional 0.5% for streets, then that would put us at 8.5%, which is right at the 60th percentile across the state.
Okay. Now, this chart takes a look at the areas of the local economy and how they track in Morro Bay versus statewide averages. So this is in terms of where you get your sales tax. Areas in which you are, let's go to the bottom. Areas in which you are strong are ones that tend to reflect the impact of tourism. So food and drugs, fuel and service stations, hotels, restaurants. Sales tax generated by any of those categories. You're the red bar, so your sales tax makeup is much more heavily weighted to those areas than a typical city. You are comparable, roughly, a little below, but roughly comparable in terms of building construction and the state and county pools. And what the pools are is money that can't be allocated to a cash register in Morro Bay, but which it's been determined under state law that you're getting a pro rata share. So a lot of internet sales fall into that category, some other specialty categories of transactions. And so you're roughly on a par there. The areas where you're weak are auto transportation, business and industry. This is businesses selling directly to other businesses, and then general consumer goods. On a statewide basis, the composition of a typical city is much greater in those areas. So this is suggestive of the fact that because you're heavily into tourism, you have more of your transactions in these areas that serve tourists, and you're weak in these areas where either you have existing residents that this is referred to as leakage, their purchases are going out of town because they feel that they don't have the choice that they want within town, so they'll go to a bigger city, San Luis Obispo, for example, for a car, for some major consumer goods. Business and industry, that is really individual businesses that are producing a product, whether it's software or medical devices or anything else, but they're selling it directly to another business. It's really not at a retail level. That oftentimes is kind of luck of the draw as to what you might get. Sometimes you'll find that cities that are more in a transportation center will get people in business parks that are from within the warehouse, not just storing something, they're producing it and then selling it. So because you're a little bit further removed from the population base of the county, I think you've tended to be a little lower in that category. But this is indicative of the areas that you want to work on, because to the extent that you can shore up your sales tax base in that area, is that you'll get more growth because it's, in the case of general consumer goods, it's purchases that are going out of town right now by your own residents often.
So if I could, the first, the general consumer goods is a two-edged sword, right? The cities hardest hit by the recession are the ones that have the biggest bars there. Then when Best Buy, when you're, or Walmart, you got all sorts of sales tax coming in from that, and when the recession hits, nobody's going to Best Buy, then so the bad news is we don't have a significant sales tax. Sales tax is 18% of our total revenues. In a normal city, it's what, more in the 30 category. But the good news is, as you've seen now in two slides, when the recession hits, we are less affected by that. The other thing you could ask is, what's not shown here, of course, is the benefit of having business, multiple head of household jobs that are not in the sales business. So if you had a software development company or a medical, you know, research thing, company or something, there's a benefit to having those businesses in with high incomes, high wages that would contribute to all of the other areas. Although a lot of those folks would still be going to slower Atascadero for their big box purchases. But the area that we've all talked about, I think that perhaps we could improve that general consumer goods is more diversity and more depth and more selection in the area of our retail downtown business district, especially if there were some additional shops that had a different quality, I guess I could say, of product. That is a place where we could affect positively the general consumer goods number and the sales tax.
Okay, and so now take a look at revenue per capita with the sales tax. Much different picture. Morro Bay is very close to the statewide average, ranks lower than the comparison cities, little bit below the median. But again, some area for improvement in that area. Okay, in terms of the revenue trends and forecast, same type of chart, revenue level on the left, percentage change here on the right. Sales tax was much harder hit during the recession. You see these the yellow bars here. You had a loss of about 6% 1 year and about 12.5% the next. So revenues actually declined pretty sharply. Then began to rebound, so you can see fairly high percentage rates, and that's often typical after a recession. People stop buying discretionary items, but when they feel like the coast is clear, they'll come out and buy. So you'll get this catch-up. In a lot of cities, auto sales had a big impact on that. People put off buying cars. As soon as they felt like things were stable, everybody went out and got a new car, and there was a huge surge statewide in the auto sales. Not so much of an issue here because your auto sales are less. But you can see the revenue has come up. Then there's another dip, and that dip is fuel prices. You are heavy into sales on fuel here, and so as gas prices go down, revenue goes down. Then we expect a little pop-up here next year, fiscal 16. And then in fiscal 17, a couple of things are going on, layered one on top of the other. I mentioned the triple flip is phasing out. And there is a cash flow associated with that. When the triple flip started, cities got shorted and by a quarter's worth of payment. And now, here 10 years later, when it ends, you're going to get that back. So there will be part of the reason why fiscal 16 is up is that there is some extra one-time money that's coming in associated with the end of the triple flip and the timing of the payments the state gives you on that. Fiscal 17, if nothing else were going on, by comparison, it would look not as good because anytime you get a spike the year before and it's one time, you're not going to repeat that. So it's going to look like you went down. Compounding that, fiscal 17 is when we're predicting the recession to occur. So this slowdown here is kind of a double whammy. Then we assume recovery from the recession and growth going on thereafter at about a 3% ongoing rate. And this is a prediction by the HDL company that does the sales tax auditing for the city. So this is pretty much the profile that we're looking at here. A couple of ups and downs, and as you're doing your budget, you need to keep that in mind. If the up year looks good, you know, remember that the next year is probably going to go down in 17 because of the recession, and it's been going down currently because of fuel sales. So that's the profile for the sales tax.
What we see here again is we've projected a 3% growth in sales tax, and that's just really a CPI function primarily. That is not an improvement in pricing or options or volume of shopping. You'll see that also in the TOT. That was essentially the 2 or 3% we used. When we get to the expense side, we'll see the same thing. We've got increased expenses that go along with the same side. So we're about to finish the sales tax side. Next up is TOT. Any questions on sales tax?
One on this. Mm-hmm. So I just want to reiterate that this is based on the modeling that exists as far as the prediction of the growth. In other words, the growth in which the business retail businesses that we have. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if we had a growth in more businesses coming to Morro Bay and opening a retail business, not to say Best Buy or anybody like that's coming to Morro Bay, but if we had some of that, that's not part of this model.
Correct.
We're just dealing with what we have today.
That's correct.
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that, so what you described is the one way to make that blue line go higher and get more streets paved. Because what you're going to see is that blue line is close to in line with the red line we're going to see that's called expenses coming up. And so we have a dog paddling forecast right now. Essentially, we are staying just about above the water, and we're working hard to stay above the water. If we wanted to make progress, it's either what you described, more places to do business, or a higher end level of doing business in the sales tax area. So instead of one of the few T-shirt shops were converted to a jewelry shop, and there was somebody here that wanted to shop at it, that would make a huge difference too.
Just a couple other quick points. In terms of growth drivers and the revenue for the future, each time HDL does a quarterly update, they do take a look at everything, all the churning that's going on with businesses that are closing or opening, and they do adjust their forecast based on what's currently happening. But unless working with the city, the city says you can count on this particular store opening maybe 6 months from now, they're not going to do anything other than what's currently happening right now, just to be conservative. Because you are so exposed on fuel, as prices go up and down, that will have a greater proportionate impact on your sales tax than it would in other cities, just because of your reliance on that. And the other is that the pools I mentioned include internet sales, and those are not necessarily linked to the sales that somebody within Morro Bay makes on the computer or phone to Amazon to have something delivered. Those revenues are charged to the pools, and you're getting a share essentially based on your proportionate share of sales statewide. But as more and more sales get driven towards the internet, you are, and collection gets better, you are getting a faster growth in the pool than you are in other places. A lot of cities are seeing 5 to 7% annual growth in the pool, and sometimes 10%. So that's a part of the overall plan to watch. And again, it's not sales that come out of a given cash register in town. It's allocated according to a formula by the state. Okay.
Mr. Leland?
Yes.
Can I just confirm something, though? The assumption would be, though, if someone has a dollar and they're going to spend it either online or at a shop here in Morro Bay, a Morro Bay resident, we'd much prefer them, as far as that, the effect of that dollar, to shop here in Morro Bay rather than online.
Oh, sure. You
can.
Want that bricks and mortar sale locally as opposed to a virtual sale online.
So that that participation in the pool is helpful, but it's not something that's returning a significant amount in terms of what a local decision to where to spend money.
That's right. It's not going to reflect any economic development efforts that you're making locally. That's kind of the luck of the draw as to what's happening with the economy and statewide getting your little share of the total.
Before we go to TOT, let me just make a parenthetical comment here. Where do our taxes go? So you saw that of all of the property taxes that we pay, only 13% of that comes back to the city. Whatever 13 minus 100 minus 13 is?
87
cents of every one of those dollars goes somewhere else. On sales tax, of the 8% we pay, about 18% comes to the city. Through sales, or one into the general fund, and then 0.5% into Measure Q. So those are actually pretty, and then of income tax, state income tax, zero comes to the city. So I've asked myself, where do all those taxes go? And look at our city budget, and the answer is not a whole lot come to the city of the significant amount of taxes that that everyone pays. None of the state income tax ends up here in real dollars. Some of it ends up in services. Same with county services, but 13% of property tax comes to the city, 18% of sales tax. Now we're getting to the areas where all of it or a significant amount of it comes to the city. TOT, and then we'll talk about
that. I was going to say that's a good segue for the TOT because that is all yours. The 10% rate that the city levies, as you can see, these are all the rates levied statewide. And 10% is the preferred rate. That's where almost everybody is. There are actually some cities that don't levy this tax, which is surprising because it's pretty much something you can charge on somebody else, you know, not your own residents. But and every city in San Luis Obispo County levies the same 10% rate. So in terms of where this revenue comes from, 86% of it, about $2.2 million, comes from motels. And 7% from vacation rentals and another 7% from trailer park. This chart shows what the average growth rates have been in the last few years, and we'll see the overall chart in a moment. But over the last 5 years, 8.8% average annual growth, that's high, from motels, about half of that from trailers. Vacation rentals, as those are becoming, I think, more popular and people are converting properties to that use, it's been quite high. If you switch down to just the last 5 months, actually, motels have been increasing at a higher rate. Trailer park collections have lagged. Vacation rentals are booming. So what does this tell us? Life is good, but I think you can't count on this forever. I mean, unless you get more properties developed as motels, and there it's a matter of absorption. I mean, there's only so many people that are going to come and stay in them. You can only get occupancy up so much, and you can only have so much catch-up in rates. And I know your local folks have been trying to get rates up, and occupancy rates have been improving, but this can't continue ongoing. So the question is, what's it going to look like over time? And, well, just I'll come back to this one in a second. So here's the revenue trends and forecast. Before the recession, revenues were increasing at this roughly 8% rate a year. You did take a plunge during the recession, no question about that. Revenues dropped off. But as soon as the coast was clear, the customers came back, and the last several years have been boom years. And so revenue has escalated rapidly. We are expecting the drop-off in 17. That, again, is linked to the anticipated recession. And then it will continue thereafter about a 3% ongoing growth after some catch-up in the immediate post-recession years. So the budget for this year was very conservative, $2.25 million. And looking at an analysis of what's come in over the past several months, of this fiscal year, we're projecting almost $2.8 million. So you're going to be much better off from the TOT. The question is whether that rate of growth is going to continue, and we're suggesting that it won't. But again, maybe we're being a little conservative. Maybe it'll drop off more slowly. Instead of being 3% the following year, maybe it'll be 5 or 6. I think what you're going to want to do with the TOT, looking very carefully at that, is not assume that you can continue that, but you might want to look at the opportunity to take some of that growth, if it comes in over the forecast, and set it aside, either in a reserve or for special use, figuring that it's not going to continue at that pace. But to the extent that the TOT base increases, that's all good. We do think that a 3% ongoing growth, which is a percent higher than the 2% CPI forecast, is probably reasonable. I think it's probably unreasonable to think that it's going to grow at 6 or 7 or 8% a year. I think that's a recipe for trouble if you assume that and then start predicating your ongoing expenditures on that TOT, because that is the most volatile part of your general fund budgetary resource. And it's a precious commodity, and you were fortunate to have it, but I think that for future growth assumptions, something a little in excess of CPI is a safer bet, and you just continue to watch it, and to the extent that you do better in 1 year, you say that's great, we'll set it aside for a one-time use and not increase staffing, let's say, based on that 1 year's collection, because the growth may go down.
Two things on this. One is the one way that could move to a sustained 4, 5, or 6% growth over a period of time would be just like if there's more shopping available, if there's more rooms available. So this 3% growth is based on basic CPI-ish inflation growth in the current number of rooms. Bob explained, you know, there's a ceiling on TOT because there's only a certain number of hotel rooms out there. And so as soon as those are all filled up, you can't fill them any further. So there is an absolute lid on or a threshold on TOT. The way to grow that slice of the pie further is to have more rooms available. And in a second, if there's a tendency, I think I've sensed, for us to attribute those golden bars in the middle of this chart to a significant part to the TBID. So I'd encourage you to look on the left-hand side of the chart and see, and then draw the line from those two bars on the left-hand side at the 3.5 million point, and just sort of project a modest growth from there, and that's about where the city would be had it not been for the recession. Does the TBID do great work and have an effect? I think it does, but it's a moderate effect upon on the top of that. Not all of those golden bars in the middle can be attributed to the TBID.
And just I was going to say, before we leave TOT, just again wanted to show you where you stand for the comparison cities. Above the median, not as high as Pismo and Half Moon Bay, but above the median of the comparison cities, the statewide amount is virtually nothing, and that's not surprising because most places in the state are not destinations, and so they don't have high TOTs. So this is a comparison. You've got $197 per capita. The statewide average is $12. So clearly TOT doesn't make a big impact for a typical city statewide, but it is huge for you.
Christina, question, and then John. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Hi, thanks. I do have a question. As an economist, Mr. Leland, how would you describe to the public in a simple terms why we say, or why you say in this report, that our TOT is our most volatile revenue source of all?
Because it is dependent on discretionary income. It's not your typical purchases that are made to get you through your day-to-day life. It tends to be something special. You're going out of town, going someplace. And those are the first expenditures that are scratched off your list if there are other items competing. And it's sensitive to unemployment. It can even be sensitive to gas price. If it gets too high, a lot of people decide they're not going to drive, and people can't easily fly into Morro Bay, so it's driving, like I did today, you know, five-hour drive. And so some people will say, well, if gas price is too high, I don't want to come. So that's why I say it is... And also there are some collection issues with it. For example, on the vacation rentals, just tracking these folks down and getting them signed up, there's probably an aspect of TOT that's not being collected because you haven't tracked these folks down yet. And there is an increasing trend, I don't know how it plays out locally here, but toward people doing Airbnb, you know, VRBOs. A lot of these are not known to the local jurisdictions, and therefore they're not getting taxed. And so a person that might have gone to a hotel or motel where the tax is an automatic collection, in the future, there are some trends going on that could alter that. And so it's volatile from the standpoint of discretionary income. It's the first thing that tends to go. And also because there are some trends occurring that make things slightly unstable at the margins, some people could shift their stay into something that becomes untaxable.
Great, thank you.
Before we turn over to John, just one comment on that is, so as we went through the whole mass audit thing, audits are things that good organizations do. That was one of our themes. We are identifying vacation rentals through the mass audit, and you know, the $137 business license is not what we're really after. It's generally the idea of fair play, fair trade. But now we know that VBRO exists, and there's a whole TOT revenue stream that we can then go follow up on and say, not only do you have a business, need a business license, but you also need to fill out one of these TOT forms, so that the residual effect of something like just a basic audit, such as the business license audit, is far broader and deeper, just for good business practice in the city, than simply about having a business license you taped your door. Mr. Heading?
Bob, you made a couple of comments, or you made a comment that was consistent across both the TOT and the sales tax revenues, and that was this, and I'll just use the word quality of product versus quantity of product, that can have a tremendous impact on capturing a certain type of disposable income. In other words, rather than, for instance, with TOT, just absolutely adding more of the same rooms, there may be a quality issue in terms of the type of product that might need to be added that would look into that could contribute significantly to drawing a consumer with more disposable income.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Correct.
Sure.
And then just a follow-up question to that. Did you dig down at all in terms of the tremendous difference in impact dollar-wise per capita on the TOT between Pismo Beach and the other entities?
I have not personally had an opportunity to do that.
We were just doing the math. I was going to bring that up as the answer to your question. So their population is maybe 2,000 or 3,000 less than us.
Right.
So let's say 20% less.
Right.
That's 900 to what 200. That's a lot more than 20% less. They have eclipses.
Right.
So this goes to the quality of product question.
Right.
They are, first, their marketing is doing quite well. Their branding is doing quite well. But also the room rate at many of those establishments is significantly higher than the room rate at many of our establishments. So that's, they have a quality of product, as you were just saying, that is in some areas substantially different from ours.
And again, on a per capita comparison, Pismo Beach probably has a higher volume of tourists, more rooms, also some of those that are higher end rooms, and the lower population. So when you're taking, right. So it's generating more TOT and there's fewer local residents. So the proportion of tourists to residents is, would be higher there. So I would say those off the top of my head, one could drill down more and ask Pismo Beach for some more detail and probably confirm that those are the general trends.
Well, 450% variation is huge.
I just wanted to point out really quickly before you leave that slide that Half Moon Bay is not that much larger than Morro Bay, but they do have a Ritz-Carlton. So I think we just want to point out that that's what we're seeing. I just made sure that was right. So not a community much bigger, but certainly a much larger draw.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving off the top three taxes, we just wanted to focus a little bit on fees and permit collections, which have lagged significantly. The chart on the left shows on the top the solid squares, the actual revenues, and with the hollow squares, inflation-adjusted revenues. And fees have lost over this period about 23.5% of their purchasing power, and so they're declining both in absolute terms and in real terms. Clearly, a lot of these fees were driven more by development, which, although it's never been real high, was higher prior to the recession than it is now. If you take a look at the cost recovery by department, a couple of interesting things show up. Public services, which includes the planning-related fees and public works fees associated with development, was at a 50 to 60% recovery rate pre-recession. That has plummeted, got as low as about 18%. It has come back and has been playing with the 30% level up and down for several years since. So you look at this roughly 30% recovery rate, it's half of the top peak of 60. And one of the things that tells me is, one is that there's less activity, obviously, to collect fees on, but the other is the fee levels at only a 30% recovery. That's low for a community development type of activity, including the associated public works functions. The other, this green line, is for recreation. And although it's held relatively steady over time, it dipped some because, again, discretionary spending during the recession, and it's kind of recovered since. It's averaged 17%. That is half of the national average, which is 34% for recreation. So, again, I think these are areas that you're going to want to take a look at. Anecdotally, talking with staff, a lot of fees have not been kept up with inflation, or there have not been proper studies done to weigh the cost recovery versus the fees being collected, the level of fees, to the cost associated with providing that service. So I include these two charts as just an indication that fees are a ripe area for review in terms of improving performance financially and helping to shore up the condition that we'll show you here a few slides down in terms of the balance trends for the city.
So there are, your staff spent 2 hours yesterday morning talking about fee subsidies, and as you know, we intend to bring to you in the next month first a discussion on the subsidy level for different fees, a philosophical discussion. What's the right level to subsidize somebody else's new home versus the right level to subsidize a senior program or something else? And so so that's the first step. We'll bring that to you for your discussion and direction. And we're also looking again at what the actual cost of providing those services are. And there's a little bit of depression, not just looking at the things and feeling badly, but in some of these numbers, because, for example, there are services that we provide that we intentionally don't want to recover anything on. And so some of these numbers are low because of that. For example, the Christmas tree lighting is something that, you know, we don't charge for. That's just something free. It's good for the community. But so our that's cost recovery. I should That says cost recovery by department. That's taking the entire department's budget essentially against that department's revenue. Vice cost recovery by activity, such as building permits or planning, whatever he calls those planning things, or a certain recreation program or something. But that said, so those numbers are not quite as bad as they show there, but we are nowhere. Well, but we do need to look hard at our cost recovery across all of our fees.
Yeah. You know, in a lot of larger cities, they will have a development services fund where all of their costs associated with development are not within the general fund. They're moved to the separate fund where they are totally paid for by fees. So that's 100% cost recovery, just to give you an example. There will be times when development is low where fees will come down. And in a situation like that, you have to have a stabilized situation with enough reserves so that you can weather an economic downturn. But here, it's all embedded within the general fund, so we'd like to see the recovery get up to a little higher level.
Christine?
Two brief questions. So when you're saying under the chart on the left, significant subsidies of user fee-supported activities by general taxpayers, could you give us one or two examples so that folks understand what that is?
Sure. Basically, any of these user-supported activities, like, say, recreation, if they're generating 17% of their cost, then the general fund as a whole, meaning all of these other tax sources, are making up the other 83%. And
let me take the one that's a little sharper point. I want to build an extension on my house. I go to the building department, planning department, and do all the stuff over there. I'm going to end up paying 50 cents on the dollar of what it costs the city to provide that service, and all of the rest of the taxpayers are going to subsidize the other 50%.
Okay, so that does include development.
That's this philosophical mm-hmm. discussion to have coming up is that appropriate for the second story on my home? You can decide how much is appropriate. But then you also can decide how much is appropriate for a senior program or a youth program or transportation or other things. You might find a different number in all of those areas based on the common good for the whole community of what that service is.
Great. That said, and then what is Management Partners finding about recovering 30% of what we recover? What do you see other cities recovering?
Well, like I say, some are set up to recover 100%. I mean, it may vary, again, depending on level of development.
Without the special fund.
Yeah, as of yesterday, in community development, Paso, Atascadero, and Pismo are all at 100% fee recovery in every community development function.
Yeah.
As of yesterday.
Okay.
So to wrap up on revenues, these are the historical and forecasted trends for these major revenue sources. You can see property tax is far and away the largest, but TOT is growing. You can see the gap is closing here compared to what it was sort of during the recession and what it will be here. I mean, you could conceivably, far enough down the line, get to the point where the TOT is your biggest revenue source. And then the blue is sales tax. I wanted to point out, we didn't talk previously about interfund transfers, but this is where the general fund incurs a cost for a capital project, let's say, and another funding source of the city reimburses it. And so money is transferred into the general fund to offset it. That's this black line, and you can see up, down, up, down, up, down. You know, it's not a recurring situation. There'll be a major project, and to the extent that the general fund can get recovery from that, then you get these peaks. So, again, you can't plan on revenue continuing to be at this level, and it's really just offsetting an expense that the general fund had. Fees and permits are down here at the bottom, and all other revenue, including business tax, are this pink line here. So now we're going to go to expenditures.
So let's pause. Any questions? So we finished revenue now, and we discussed that there we get nothing from state income tax. We have talked about sales tax, and or I guess first we went to property tax, and did not have a significant hit on property tax as a result of the recession. Really, same on TOT, although it's volatile. I think the whole recession hit was about $250,000 of revenue during that period, which, in the big scheme of things, is fairly moderate. And then we just talked about fees, where the city has probably some room to do some work to ensure that we are have everything pegged appropriately. And those, and TOT and fees are areas that 100% of that comes to the city. And we should be very careful how we say that, because when it comes to fees, what we're talking about is simply paying what it costs to provide that service. It's really like water. How much, you know, we don't tax water. We only charge water based on how much it costs us to provide an acre foot of water coming out of your tap. And that's the same way to think about fees. We're not allowed to intentionally make money.
Yeah.
You know, increase revenues with fees. Fees have to be pegged at how much it costs the city to provide that service. So about the leave revenue move to expenses, John.
Well, just to comment on other revenues, if you stratified it and you looked at just like a Pareto analysis on it, you're looking at, you know, fully 60% of it coming from three sources: $824,000 in fees, $802,000 in the cap transfer in, and $516,000 in franchises. So it's really, you know, three entities that are producing 60% of the issue.
Okay, so let's go to expenditures. Nearly three quarters of what you spend in the general fund is on people. And it's people that provide the service. This is very typical. We're finding cities are generally from two-thirds to 75% in terms of what their spending is on. Now, that can vary. In some cases, the general funds pay debt service, or they pay for more capital projects than another city. So this amount can fluctuate. But again, most of your eggs are in that personnel basket. And when it comes considering any potential in reducing expenditures, that's the area that's most likely to be affected. Now, a couple of charts here relating to personnel. The chart on the left shows authorized staffing in full-time equivalent positions. The line on the top is for the general fund, the line on the bottom for the enterprise funds. So you can see that the general fund from 2000 slowly increased to its peak in about 2004 or 5, and then as the recession took hold, declined. And you have gone down almost 12 positions, or 21% from the peak. So general fund positions have been down. Enterprise positions slowly increased from 2000 through about 2008 or 9, and have pretty much plateaued at that point. But during the period of increase, gained 6.5 positions, or 30% increase. This is largely a reflection of where the resources are. Enterprise funds are more capable, as resources increase over time, of meeting their staffing needs. On the other hand, the general fund undoubtedly had staffing needs either at this level of the peak or in excess of that, but because of a lack of resources has not been able to afford any more than this lower level, just over 70 FTE. Now, an interesting thing here, if you come over here and take a look at the general fund expenditure trends by type, the blue line on the top is personnel. And over time, although it's dipped for the recession, overall it has been a very slow increase from over this period of 7%. You say, well, how is that possible? You have fewer positions and yet costs went up. Well, compensation for the positions that you have has to be taken into account, and there were times when that was increased. And you've had significant increases in pension expenses, and we're going to talk more about that in a moment, because they're going to get higher in some respects and lower in another, and we'll go over that. But I wanted to point out that even though general fund staffing levels are lower, there has been this general increase over time in personnel costs. The orange line, which is other services and supplies, other operations and maintenance costs, have actually gone down 25%. And we often see that as well, and that's a reflection of a couple of things. Cities, the last thing they want to cut is people, and so where possible, they will cut, squeeze, and trim everything else. Sometimes taking away the resources the people that are kept on the job need to get their job done. Also, that's a reflection of replacements of equipment, replacement of technology, replacement of vehicles. During times of cutbacks, cities stop doing it, and they just try to keep the stuff on the road or the computers running a little bit longer, sometimes past their useful life. This is a situation that makes it difficult for the sustainability of the organization long term, because there is a certain amount of reinvestment in the organization that's required. And I understand, because as a finance director, I did it myself, you try to cut everywhere else except the people, because that's a valuable resource, and there's an institutional memory and experience, and you let those people go, and it leaves you worse off in the future. But your trend is pretty typical. Some creep up in personnel costs, some overall decline in non-personnel costs. This last line that's kind of hard to see here, the green, is capital expenses, and that's volatile because that's driven by these capital projects. And as you can see, there was the one project in 2009 that drove costs up, and there's some costs here about a year ago, but other times it could be close to zero. So capital is up and down, and it tends to be only undertaken when you've got the resources to do it, but it's not a recurring expense. So I just wanted to give you that overall profile in terms of personnel versus other.
Can I make a couple of quick comments here? First, on the previous slide, that big old, if I could just pop back, that big old chunk of blue, we like to get concerned and say, what are all these people doing? That's such a big piece of the pie, and clearly it is. So the two fine officers over there wearing blue, the fire chief and the police chief, they account for almost 50% of that. So, and I'm not those two themselves, but the services provide. So, the services provided by our fire department and our police department account for about 50% of those people, and so that leads to the next comment. If you go forward one, Bob, a 20% decline in personnel over 8, 9, 10 years is a significant decline. And you'll recall this is the first half of the management partners report. The second half is coming in May, but we've been in great communication with their team. And surprisingly to me, their initial sort of azimuth check with us had very little in the way of, hey, you could cut some of this and cut some of that, and had a whole lot in the way of, you are understaffed here and understaffed there, and under-resourced here, IT, for example, and are not getting, and are not providing, and therefore are not able to provide the service that you need to provide. So minus 21% of staff, that's what happens. So I guess I'd just say the low-hanging fruit has been harvested. And then I'm not sure this completely came out to me until I just looked at this again. But it's sort of scary when you see that 21% decline over 10 years, but you see the cost of personnel going up by 21.4% over the exact same period. You would expect to see a 21% decline, but as we're about to move to, the because of decisions we and almost every other city in California have made over the last 20 years, our pension rates are significant, and they are increasing significantly. And so that's that cost is that's not just in, hey, let's take care of the boys, let's just throw some more salary on there. This is in a sense, because of the CalPERS, this is sort of a precursor to the CalPERS slide, but because of the CalPERS pension system and required contributions, a lot of which has been out of our control, instead of seeing a 21% decline in the cost of labor as we cut 21% of our people, we saw about a 21% increase.
Okay, so what you see here is bringing us up to the current 2015. So now we're going to take a look forward. What are our assumptions in terms of personnel costs for the coming years? And these are important. So to start with, we're assuming no change in budgeted staffing levels. Now, that does not mean that workload increases are not occurring, but what it means is that about the only way you're going to be able to address them is through efficiencies and increased productivity, which is what most cities have been doing and, frankly, what you've been doing over the past several years. The city payroll projections that were originally budgeted for this current year have been updated with MOU changes and including whatever changes fall over to the next fiscal year. We've assumed a continuation of step increases for people that are below top step. A discussion we have with every city is their labor market. And you know, we're not negotiating here. Everything in terms of compensation, salary, and benefits is a meet and confer item, and you can be at the bargaining table as often as continuously. it could be once a year. But what we're trying to show with the model is what the inflationary pressures are. And everybody has a labor market, and to a certain extent, in any given year, you might say, we're not going to have an increase. And recently, there's been more than 1 year in a row where there haven't been increases. But over time, things tend to even out. There will be these inflationary pressures that will be felt. And so we have built those in throughout the model. So we're assuming 2% growth, which is the same as the CPI forecast. And that's a reasonable assumption. The same with increases in health contributions. We haven't assumed any other benefit changes. Now, in terms of two notes, one on the salaries. This is calculated as if it were a 2% across the board COLA, but the reality is your staff is going to take a look at those positions where you have difficulty recruiting and retaining, and there may be some increases that are greater in an area such as that. And maybe a lesser amount for an across the board, but we're not trying to prejudge how that's done. We're just coming up with an amount that in the aggregate is equal to a 2% COLA. It'll be up to negotiations to determine that. In terms of health, there's really two issues going on here. One is what happens to premiums. That may be a much higher growth than 2%. But the other part of that is what is the city's contribution going to be? It's locked in right now. It doesn't automatically float as premiums go up. You're fortunate because there are some cities with contracts that do link to premiums, and as they go up, if they go up 20%, your health costs go up 20%. Here, it's up to your meet and confer process to determine what that growth is in the future. We've assumed the contribution, since health is a major area, we'll go up with CPI, but just like with salaries, that's a negotiating item for the city to take a look at. One thing that we will point out is that it isn't really an option in terms of sustainability is to go back and say there were years in the past when you didn't get increases, we're now going to make up for that. Were you to do that, it would put the city into the hole in future years, and we can show you, if we have time to look at the model, what some specific examples of that would be. So overall salary growth is about 3.5%, and that includes inflationary growth, and it includes merit increases, which on a composite will be about 1.5%. It varies because if you get a merit, it's a 5% increase, but if you're at top step, you get zero. So you have to take a look at the whole organization. And that'll change over time, but 1.5% is probably a pretty good indicator for right now. CalPERS, their assumptions on a statewide basis are 3%, but that's a combination of a lot of things, inflation, merit increases, people retiring, lower paid people coming in. So I think we're in the ballpark with this overall growth. We've also built in vacancy savings. What we've done initially with this budget staffing level, we've taken a look at all positions, including those that are vacant. They're all budgeted as if they will be there for the whole year. But the reality is they won't all be there for the whole year. There's always turnover. And so you build in a budgeted offset, and that's we've budgeted 3% of the total. So that means 97% of the gross expense we're assuming is going to be spent, and 3% won't. 3% is sort of an industry standard in normal times. These aren't necessarily normal times. Some vacancies have been carried that would put you at a higher rate than 3%. But the problem with assuming too high a vacancy rate over 10 years is that that's locking you out of the flexibility of getting a position that's vacant today filled in the future. I mean, if we were to budget this at 5-6% vacancy rate, then you're going to be stuck holding these vacancies vacant forever, and essentially it's like saying you might as well eliminate them because you're not going to get to fill them. So 3% seems to be a reasonable level there. And then we get to CalPERS. We've done a special analysis. Our firm takes a look at each plan and each tier of that plan and builds in the Public Employees Pension Reform Act impacts that affect benefit levels, which mean that for somebody who is in a Tier 1, they're a classic employee, grandfathered, as it were, into the old level of benefits, someday that position's going to, you know, leave. They'll move to another job or retire, and you'll fill that position. Could be with somebody who's currently a PERS member, and if so, they get grandfathered in. But over time, they're going to become new hires, not classic. And the new hires get the lower benefits. And so we've built that trend in over time. It's not an actuarial model. You'd have to pay an actuary extra to come in and do that. But it takes into account each of the tiers of unfunded liability. And the state can define as few as 3 or 4 and as many as 15 or 20 for some cities. And these amounts of unfunded liability are all for different purposes, and they all amortize over different periods of time. And so we've taken these different layers, like layers of a wedding cake, and over time they get paid off, and changes happen along with the PEPRA. So we're going to take a look.
Before you go on, Bob.
Yes.
So this perhaps is the most important slide when we think about what we're talking about going forward, because you've probably heard it before, but what does it mean to assume? Assuming poorly is making an ass out of you and me. So what's really important is what assumptions are we making going forward in our budgeting, and that we're making these assumptions wisely. So I wanted to make a couple comments and then give the council a chance to dig into some of these assumptions and make us defend them.
Uh-huh.
So the first thing I would point out is that while the top bullet is true, this model that you're about to see does not allocate any additional staff. It does allocate $100,000 a year for some important project, and that could be a $100,000 staff member. So there is $100,000 annually built into this of unallocated revenue available, which could be, for example, one code enforcement officer, or it could be $100,000 of something else each year. The second thing is that this, as Bob well said, it assumes inflationary growth, but does not assume, and nor should it, any other measurable salary increases or other increases. And so that 2% is not a given, as far as I'm concerned. As Bob said, this is not a negotiation that we're talking through right now. My general assumption going into negotiations is that's a zero. And then we look at what the drivers are of why it should be something other than zero. But in order to be wise over time, it is likely that over 10 years it's not going to be zero. It's likely there are going to be drivers. So we've chosen 2% as an appropriate number, but that commits us to nothing as far as future negotiations. The 2% health contribution, it's important to, and I like quadruple checked this mm-hmm. with Bob and Susan, the way that our system works, and thankfully we've got it laid out this way, is the city contributes a fixed amount to health. Regardless of the cost of health, there's still a meet and confer, but in our contracts and our negotiations. So if health insurance premiums went up 10% in the next year, there is nothing that compels the city to increase our health insurance contribution by 10%. And we've assumed a 2% increase each year over the decade of this forecast. But while we would certainly be concerned and want to take a look at ensuring our employees had appropriate health care, there is skyrocketing health care costs, health care premiums would not sink this forecast because that is not built into anybody's contract. And finally, the vacancy rate, good discussion there. I'm comfortable with 3%. I will tell you that we've developed a transformation policy, a staff succession policy. Thank you. In my perfect world, Susan's going to retire in 2035. Mm-hmm. Sorry. In 2018. And if Susan is retiring in December of 2018, I'd like her replacement on board in about October of 2018, because it's better for the organization, frankly, to have some transition and have a thoughtful succession than it is to have these massive gaps. I've been in organizations that funded their deficit purposely by doing this and purposely by increasing the vacancy rate and saying you can't hire anybody until that position has been empty for 6 months. Mm-hmm. That's not a good way to run an organization. But I'm comfortable with this because there are going to be plenty of times when somebody announces their retirement or plops their retirement right on your desk, nor are we going to run out and hire the first person off the street to replace them. We're going to go through a deliberate process of finding the right person for the right position. So I think that's about correct. Okay. So I'd like to ask the council if they have any questions on the assumptions here. In general, we're going to go through some of them in particular, and specifically we're going to talk about the PERS piece in detail on the upcoming slides.
Ready for PERS?
John,
any questions? All right, this is a very interesting slide. It shows the effective composite rate as a percent of payroll for police in blue, fire in red, and miscellaneous in green. These projections are based on the most recent information we have from CalPERS, which is their 2013 actuarial valuation. It incorporates all of their rate smoothing and amortization changes, which are driving costs up over the next 5 years, as well as their mortality improvements, which are doing the same, increases over 5 years. It uses their current discount rate of 7.5%. That's essentially the rate of return that they're assuming that they'll get on their invested funds. And then, as I mentioned, it includes PEPRA impact. CalPERS actually doesn't take into account PEPRA impact. They have a static look at the world in 2013, and although their projections go through 2021, they do not incorporate any assumed turnover of employees, which, of course, is going to happen. So we do build that in. Now, we'll go through each of these. What I'll tell you is that for most cities, what they're looking at is a rapid increase over the next 5 years, more or less of a plateau as the ongoing impact of PEPRA kicks in, as more and more people convert to the lower benefits. And then as they begin to hit the amortization periods for these chunks of unfunded liability, it drops down in kind of a stair-step fashion. So it's up sharply over 5 years, plateaus, and then stair-step down until you get way out to the 2040s. And all things being equal at that point, there'll be no more unfunded liability, knock on wood, and all you'll be left with is the normal cost rate, and the normal cost is essentially your current cost going forward of benefits. But the assumption is that you have nothing unfunded. And, of course, that's the ideal assumption. But all the actuaries that look at this say that profile is what they expect to have happen. So the wild card in here is local demographics that could I mean, if you have more, let's say, disability retirements, that could drive costs up. If you have a different age distribution, that can affect you, pro or con. And then the other big wild card is the payment of these different levels of unfunded liability. And now you're a small city, so you are in the pools. So you don't have your own individual plan. You share it. You have a bunch of neighbors throughout the state, and they are in your plan. When the plans were first created, there was something called a side fund that was put together for each city, and that was to try to equalize the burden, because if you brought in a lot of unfunded liability, then your pool partners were going to have to pay for your, you know, profligate ways of bringing in all this unfunded liability. So the idea of equalizing it was to create these side funds. Every city has a different amount and a different time period to amortize that are in the pools. So it just so happens that your police and fire pool payments are coming due in a relatively short period of time. And so you have to overlay that impact with this overall trend of ramping up costs over 5 years. So for police, in 3 years, your side fund is paid off, and so your rate is going to drop significantly from about 42% or 43% of payroll back down to about 32%. And then you see this little uptick. That's the last uptick of the five-year phase-in. So in other words, instead of this uptick occurring as an extension of here, where you'd be way up to about 45%, you drop because of the side fund payoff, then you have the last little uptick. And then you have the plateau effect, which is the steady decline because of PEPRA, more and more people switching positions, transitioning from classic employees at higher benefits to new hires at lower benefits. And then you start hitting these payoff levels. So here's a amortization in the late 2020s. Here's one in the late 2030s, and, you know, down, 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 stair step until you get to just the normal cost level. Now, the same thing is true of fire, except their costs are higher. You're going to go up to almost 60% of payroll, which is very high for a PERS level. But once you get to a five-year period down the line, you will have amortized the side fund component of it, and then you'll drop. And then you have the same thing, the slow decline from PEPRA, and then the stair steps down. Keep in mind, though, this is a long time. Yeah, I don't know if you're planning to stick around to see how this story ends up, but that's in the 2030s and 2040s.
And there is plenty of debate in the CalPERS world about what things could go sideways during this period. So this is the best projection, but things could go sideways, you know, and it's based on a specific expected rate of return on investments, and it makes assumptions that are probably the commonly accepted assumptions, but they could go sideways. So many of us have been concerned about the CalPERS issue out there, the big bubble. So if for most other cities, so this is a good news chart for us. For most other cities, as Bob explained, if you took this whole part of the police graph here and moved it up, so this point attached to that point, that's what most other cities in California look like. A massive increase over the next 5 years, and then 10 years at that super high level, before it starts drawing down gradually over 20 years, and then some big stair steps. So good news for Morro Bay because of what we brought into the pool years ago. Whenever we went into the pool, we have 5 years of serious pain. But then we have, after 5 years, we come back to about the level we're at now, and then a very slow over time moderation down to an even better level. As you know, our pension contributions are extraordinarily high right now. What this says is in about 35 years, they won't be extraordinarily high. They might even be down around the point of what you might find as a normal 401k contribution from a private employer or a matching or something like that, at least back in the world of reason. But in the short term, we've got a significant issue in the next 5 years, and you're going to see that in the dashboard as you look at what happens to our general fund reserve over the next 5 years.
You know, a couple of key points here. That's a good summary Dave just gave you. The biggest uncertainty is rate of return. CalPERS is concerned about the volatility of their model. One of the things that they like even less than high rates that they have to charge employers is a volatility in those rates. So it goes up, down, up, down. They try to have it be more steady. And even if it's high, they want it to be steady and not volatile. And the volatility of their investments leads to that. Now, volatility works both ways. The last couple of years, the rate of return has been great. A few years back, it was negative. Anything less than 7.5% is going to add costs. And what they'll do every single year, I was talking about this wedding cake of layers of unfunded liability, every year they're going to look at all the deviations from their actuarial assumptions and plus or minus that gets put in. So some of these layers are actually minus. They say, we had such a good year that everybody gets a credit, and that's built in. So there's a 30-year amortization of a credit. Other times, it's a net loss, and so it's a 30-year amortization of a positive amount. So the big question is going to be rate of return, and the good returns of these last couple of years, all things being equal, will probably take a little bit of the edge off these when they come back next year, because they come back every year. They'll give a 5-year forecast every year, and so next year, the one good thing that they'll have is better investment returns. Now, the other thing from the past, a lot of volatility was sort of political volatility, either changes at the state level in the authorized level of benefits you could offer, and then the churning that goes on locally in negotiations in terms of what gets awarded. At least for now, the PEPRA law puts a cap on what the benefits are going to be. And unless the state law changes or there's an initiative, and let's face it, there could be an initiative come along that could, most of the initiatives that are discussed would actually curb costs rather than increase them. And so there is still a political dimension there. The voters could decide to change something, which would probably tend to knock these down. But I guess the last thing I'd say is that it's some of this is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. You think that you've got a reform act that reduces costs, but you know that in all the negotiations that go on at all local government levels, employee groups will say, well, all right, my benefits are down, but I want a higher pay. And there's already been a lot of discussion about how that's probably what's going to happen next, is that there's going to be issues of trying to negotiate for higher pay to compensate for the fact that the retirement benefit as a percent of income is down, so let's get the income up. And that way the lower percentage times the higher income won't be as much of a hit for the employees. But there again, that's a meet and confer item, and it's up to you folks to and your successors over many years in the future to deal with. But this is important. A lot of the cities that we're delivering this message to, as Dave pointed out, especially if they have their own plans and they're not in a pool, the side funds, you're more likely to have an early amortization of a side fund if you're in a pool, and a big chunk of your unfunded liability is what you brought into the pool, so that side fund has a lot of it. And so in some cases, you know, you're knocking off half of your unfunded liability in one fell swoop by having that side fund paid off, and so you can see the big decline. So you're in a fortunate position of doing that. I just gave another presentation and it wasn't so rosy. It went out for quite a period of years at a high level. And so this is what makes your situation unique, and that's why you have to look at this on a city-by-city basis. It's not a cookie cutter. It's not one size fits all. This is your story, and another city's story, you know, might be different. So I want to pick up the pace here a little bit because I know you want to get some dinner here at some point.
We like to go to midnight.
Not this group? You guys are hearty. A hearty group. All right. Actually, I should go back to this. PERS is a big issue. Does anybody have any other questions on PERS before I move on? Okay. Now, this next area, and from my angle, the color doesn't seem to be showing up very well. There's supposed to be a highlighting in here, but the forecast also looks beyond the personnel into these areas of capital and replacement costs. Remember when I said earlier a lot of cities tend to cut back on their replacement of technology and equipment and vehicles, and it puts them in a difficult position. They may have saved the bodies to perform service, but those bodies have less resources available to them that they need to get their job done. What the city has done, you have a five-year capital improvement program, and in that program there are projects identified as well as replacement costs for certain technology. But it's more of a wish list. And what we've done in the model is we have built in the funding for that. So we have taken as the our initial look what the staff has identified as the need for replacement. And so in the case of vehicles, it was only $45,000 this year, but starting next year, the next couple of years, there's a lot of catch-up. There's some big-ticket items and just a large volume. So $732,000 of replacements in fiscal 16, $300,000 in 17, $190,000 in 18, $500,000 in 19. So we have taken those amounts that have been identified in the CIP that you've adopted as part of the current budget and said we put dollars behind it and said it isn't just a wish list, it'll get done. And then on an ongoing basis, with the capital improvement plan only goes through fiscal 19, so we said, let's assume $250,000 a year thereafter. What you really need is a long-term capital, in this case, vehicle replacement plan, which takes a look at all the vehicles, their useful life, their replacement cost, and ideally you would be setting aside enough money each year, sort of as a rental of that, to pay that off. As an alternative, you might want to consider leasing certain equipment, and that becomes normal cost because you've got a certain amount that's fixed that you're paying each year. But vehicles is a big ticket item. IT, there were only 3 years identified in the CIP. They're for minor amounts. Our recommendation, which you'll see in the bigger report, is you really need an IT needs assessment. My opinion is that's an inadequate amount of money to keep you abreast of what you're going to need to do to keep the technology in place that the organization needs to run on.
Let me just make a parenthetical comment here. So, and I know you're surprised that this comes on IT. So the process with Management Partners was essentially a whole bunch of interviews with department heads, with members of departments, fact gathering, but somewhat stovepiped. That is, it hasn't all come together up to Susan and I, and that's actually going to start tomorrow morning when the staff and I spend at least 2 hours with Bob, probably starting with this slide. So the good news here is that this forecast allocates $8 million over the next 9 years for a whole bunch of things that we have been either not been funding sporadically or funding unwisely, whether it's vehicles or IT or facilities maintenance. So for example, facilities maintenance, there's $2 million going into capital improvement, as we've talked about wanting to make sure that we're putting money into those funds. That said, as Bob, where I stop Bob is, I'm uncomfortable that we've put a organizational look at this as opposed to purely a departmental look. So frankly, if you're asked me, I'd say drive all those vehicles another 10 years and let's get some IT and let's do some more saving for capital, capital savings and for maintenance. But so I'm sort of generally don't love that this shows that there's almost $3 million for vehicles and 10% of that for IT, because I look around our organization, our vehicles are in pretty good shape and our IT is horrid. So what I'm hopeful you take out of this is we are allocating money for unmet needs in this model, in this forecast, and then that I'm telling you that we're going to go back and look and make sure that we're allocating that money wisely based on what we all think that our real needs are.
Yeah, that's an important point. What we've done is, as Dave says, is we've essentially come up with $8 million that can be funded under the model. It's really, and the way that we have allocated it is based on what you've already adopted, paying deference to, you know, the current budget. But I would do the same thing Dave has suggested, which is think of it in terms of you have this much resource, now let's go back and see if you can improve on this, and maybe there are some of these areas that are higher priorities than others. Basically, the way the model works is you have a vehicle replacement fund. These amounts are charged to that fund. When it runs out of money, the general fund backfills it. And then, of course, if the general fund gets to a point of being negative, and we'll see that in a moment, you have a reserve that backfills that. So everything's linked to everything else. You also have a facility maintenance budget, and we've taken the liberty of just showing IT and fire equipment within that fund. You might ultimately decide at some point to break that out. But you have certain resources that are going into the facility maintenance fund. So we've identified these other items from the CIP for IT, fire equipment, and facilities, and then made assumptions for future years where the CIP didn't extend. And so, again, those funds would be charged for these amounts. If it runs short, the general fund is the backup for that. We've built in $200,000 a year as capital project transfers, so to the extent the general fund needs to make a contribution for capital outlay, we've put a placeholder in for that. We haven't tried to identify what the individual projects or equipment might be, but again, it's part of the overall $8 million. And then this added service that Dave mentioned a little while back, while we have assumed that staffing levels don't change, we have put this placeholder in for $100,000 with 3% growth, which can be for a high priority item from your strategic planning process. To give you a little wiggle room, it's not necessarily a capital project. It could be, 10 years of sort of $100,000 a year, one-time capital projects each time, or it could be a recurring expense that once you start it in year one, you just keep that staffing commitment and it costs you more money over time. But this is basically.
So I think you got that, but that could be a code enforcement officer,
right,
all the way through, or it could be $100,000 next year for the general plan, $103,000 the next year for a strategic, for an economic strategic development plan, $106,000 the following year for a refurbishment of the police station, and different things, or it can be one, probably one employee or one different $100,000-ish project a year. I'd also note that the IT line is a little bit deceptive because that is sort of holistic IT, looking at the whole budget but not diving down into each of the departmental budgets.
Right.
And this is a little bit of inside baseball, but I want you to hear it because you're going to see it differently in this budget process. The way that we have been doing IT is every department has their own IT budget. So Susan came in the other day and says, okay, how much do you think you need for a new computer this year? Yeah, so I don't know, maybe I need, $500, over the next 3 years so I can get one in 3 years. So it's all been departmental, and it's been departmentally actioned and planned so that this department might buy one of these kind of machines, and another one might buy something else, another one buys something else. So we're, I don't know if this is news to them, but okay, so this is news to you guys too. So this year, Susan's redoing the numbers right now, and we're going to consolidate all of IT into one account, and we're going to have an internal service fund. And essentially what that means is we buy one of those IT strategic assessment documents that also lays out how we should be acquiring equipment. We do consolidated buys of equipment. We say over this piece of equipment is going to last 3 years, and then we're going to replace it. We have a plan to do that that's deliberate, And then instead of Rob saying, guessing this year that for IT, I'm going to need to budget this amount because these three computers are going to break in that, actually what's going to happen is the IT director is going to tell Rob, I'm going to charge you this much this year, and I'm going to provide all your IT services to you, replacing these computers, buying these websites, and all these different things. So that number is, sorry, is a little bit, I just wanted you to hear that because you're going to see it differently in this budget than you did last year. And you're going to see it as a consolidated number, and I guess we're now committed to doing that because I said that out loud. But those numbers are, we're sort of on top of number. That's not our entire IT budget across, but that was sort of an add-on to get some fixes, but that is not close to where we need, even considering everything that we also we have, because some, especially for this year, some of the things that we need to be doing from a strategic assessment to CityWorks as a provider, CityWorks or somebody else as a provider who does permitting, planning, business licenses, all those things online, to really to up our user or customer facing IT capacity.
Okay. So what I'm going to do next is summarize what the cost drivers are for expense, and then we're going to go into fund balance, where the rubber hits the road. Now, what this chart shows you on the left, the yellow on the bottom is your operating budget. It starts from 2005, brings us up to 2015, where we are now, and then looks into the forecast. So there have been some peaks in spending, but this is primarily related to, again, capital projects. You have this one project in 2009. And the red on top of it is additional budget with total capital outlay. And so in certain years, it's been much, much higher because of these capital projects. When you get to 2015, looking forward, the different colored bands show where the costs are, what they're attributable to. So the yellow on the bottom is current employees, and it includes merit increases because that's part of the current MOUs. The next little band is pension, and this is not as much. It's only 6% of the total over here. The pie chart summarizes all of this and shows what the grand total is. So pension is only $900,000 or 6% of your increase. The next band, labor cost growth, because of the COLAs that are built in for salary and health, is 37% of the total. It's $5.5 million. Other services and supplies, just normal inflationary increase, that's like $1.6 million or 11% of the total. This next big batch is unmet needs, and we just went through the chart on those. The general fund portion of that's $5.3 million, 35% of the total. And you can see it's while some of these grow over time, labor, for example, if you give COLAs, it's 2% this year, but next year you get the 2% COLA you gave last year, plus you get another 2%, and it compounds over time. So labor costs widen, they get bigger over time. A lot of these unmet needs are there's a backlog of expense, and so it's more of an upfront cost. And so the additional burden it adds actually shrinks a little bit over time, and most of it's upfront. And then there's this little $200,000 a year put in for capital transfers. So this is just a way to look at what's the cause of our increase over time. And for some people, pension is a much bigger chunk of it. Labor is going to be big because, remember, it's almost 75% of your spending. And so once you start giving cost of living increases there, that goes up. Now, you can always temporarily solve your problem by saying we're not going to have any inflationary increases in labor. But one, you have to negotiate that each year. And two, over time, the market will come back to bite you. So this is just kind of a look at what the major cost drivers are. The next chart, if I can keep it moving here, is...
Mr. Lean, can yes. I ask a question?
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
sorry, just on O&M briefly. Mm-hmm. Did you also include some estimate about potential increase in cost of energy and so forth?
We do have... have increased costs for energy, but not for anything extraordinary. It's sort of inflation plus. I believe it's in a 3% annual growth rather than 2% CPI. Now that, to the extent that your energy costs, well, to the extent that some of the utility costs are water and you control the water system, then that's something you can build in over time. If you get a set of water rate increases, then and you know what those are going to be over time, then you can go back to your general fund water costs and adjust that. In terms of overall energy costs, you know, natural gas has kind of been down in recent years. Energy, electricity has generally been increasing at inflation or a little better, although the major electrical providers would like to see more than they've been getting. But we don't have any special econometric model attached to those energy costs. It's basically a little bit more than CPI.
Same with fuel?
Mm-hmm. Same with fuel. Up and down on that. I mean, you saw with the sales tax, you know, you get less sales tax when the price goes down, but from the standpoint of the gas you're buying, you're benefiting from. So it's an inverse relationship there.
Overall, our fuel costs are pretty low compared to the whole general fund budget. That said, we're today we signed a contract to get Voyager cards, so instead of essentially paying a 20% premium for each gallon of gas that we use because we have it in our own tank and we have to get in, we're essentially our own gas station. Starting soon, we'll get it for whatever the market rate is minus all the excise taxes. So, you know, what, today, $3.50 minus 50 cents, because we're going to essentially a Voyager government credit card system where we don't have to pay the excise tax, and then we won't have to have our own gas station either.
Okay, this next chart takes the expense level that we just looked at and goes back to compare it to revenues as a prelude to looking at what happens to the balances. So the yellow bars are the total amount then that the city general fund is going to spend based on this forecast. The green line is the revenue that we're forecasting. The little green tinted area around it gives you a range of optimistic to pessimistic. So the optimistic is no recession and a 0.5% ongoing improvement in growth rate. The pessimistic is with the recession, but a 0.5% less average growth rate. That is probably a pretty reasonable band. It's what we've been using for other cities. And we just use this chart to give people a sort of a visual matchup here of where revenue is likely to be. Because, you know, in any given year, it'll be higher or lower than the forecast. In fact, about the only thing I can guarantee you right now is that the revenue will not exactly match the forecast. But it's not going to be wildly one way or another, and especially not on an ongoing basis. But as changes occur and there's compounding in the base revenue, over time, the volatility, the margin for error widens naturally over time. The farther out you go, the greater the variance you're going to likely have. But it's pretty reasonable to expect that you're going to be within the green area. So then you just match up the green area with the bars and say, well, all right, we're likely to be on the line. And if that's the case, we're looking good in 15, especially with the higher TOT and a little higher property tax. You're going to put money in the bank this year. But starting with some of the costs that we're looking at next year, the yellow bars are higher than the green line. So that means you're going to be burning reserve. Once you get to a point where the green line is equal to or greater than the yellow bar, then you're in better shape. Now, you can look at the range and say, oh, I like the top of this area here. Let's just assume we'll be there. Well, that way you're assuming the best. You're an optimist. You have to be an optimist to be in local government, I think. But the problem with just assuming that your revenues are going to be on the high side all the time is that you are buying trouble, because you're going to then develop your expenditures and your labor negotiations and everything on this optimistic forecast. And when that doesn't pan out, you're going to be in trouble. So I think although any given year you could be higher or lower than the green line, the green line is our most likely forecast. And given that you've got some years of expenditures that are higher, then that is going to mean that your balance declines in those years. So,
let me just make a comment here. Mm-hmm. So, of all the things you could say about this chart, of all of the square centimeters on it, this square centimeter is pretty important. In that one, the little orange bar is above the most optimistic revenue forecast. So this says that even if that's given things as they are, if we don't change anything, which means decrease expenses or increase revenues, then even the very best projection says in 2018, if revenues are as good as we could expect and hope, our expenses are still going to be higher than revenues that year. And every time that there's one of those things, every piece of orange bar above a green line is a bit of general fund reserve that goes away. So remember the chart, the PERS chart that showed 5 years of horrificness followed by a steep downturn and back to reality. So there's 5 years of horrificness. And then right about here, the green line and the top of the yellow bar start to match. And we're closer. And so that driver is a large part of that driver is that PERS, the pension increase, and then it starts to come back into line.
So the next thing, now we're on the home stretch, balance. And we're going to look first at historical numbers. And something that needs to be clarified is that the general fund reserve is kept in a separate fund than the general fund. And when you're looking at funds in the budget, you really need to look at the composite of both of them. The general fund only has actually run deficits for the last 6 years and then back in 06. The emergency reserve has had enough in it except for 2 years when the net of both of these was negative. Now, you don't want to have a situation where they're both negative, because what you're really effectively doing at that point is you're drawing on the pooled cash of other funds that have nothing to do with the general fund and, in fact, have restrictions on them. And there are rules, Prop 218, as it affects utilities, various state laws that affect state funds, federal funds. You don't want to be in a position where you tap out both of these. And you can't do anything about the past, but we're going to fix it going forward.
Bob,
so,
pardon me.
Yes.
And on the reporting system, that would be the interdepartmental transfer issues?
Well, it's a combination of things. You mean why it was negative in these 2 years?
No. Just how it shows up.
Well, the way it shows up in the budget, you've got a fund balance, and it shows, if you look in the budget, it's negative. But if you look in the emergency reserve, it's positive. In the last several years, the net of both of those has been positive. I just say this because it's a little more confusing. Most cities have the reserve in the general fund, and so it's evident. Here you have to look in two places. But what we've done in the forecast is we've just automatically had the emergency reserve move any resource necessary in order to hold the general fund at zero. If the general fund improves on its own past zero, that's great. But if it's going to otherwise be negative, then the emergency reserve money automatically moves. That way, when you look at the emergency reserve, you really know what's left. And so what basically is happening is your reserve goal by policy is 27.5%. That has its roots in decisions that were made years back. But we will actually exceed that this year. Will hit 31.9, so it will exceed the 27.5. And again, taking both the net of both of these. And so when you look at these upcoming charts, you think about general fund and general fund reserve together. I'll also note that subsequent to the budget adoption, Dynergy made an additional payment, and so that is boosting the reserve higher. You see it went up in fiscal 15. You have had a good policy of taking one-time or non-recurring monies and putting them in reserve, thank goodness, because a lot of cities just kept it in the general fund and spent it. So this has helped a lot. And so by doing that as a policy, you have ensured that the reserve stays there instead of getting drawn down. The only thing we'd recommend is this movement of the funds in the future to just clean up what otherwise winds up being a deficit. If the funds were commingled like most cities, then you would just be looking at this bottom line here. Okay.
John, I think the answer to your question is yes. I think you were referring to those two red years and without passing judgment on them, but just sort of making a comment, is what happened in those 2 years is at the end of the year, there wasn't an interdepartmental transfer. There was an interfund transfer where, frankly, an illegal interfund transfer where money was taken from an enterprise fund such as water or sewer to cover the deficit that year. And hopefully there was a memo signed on that, and it was put back in the next year. What we were not going to, I don't know where that's the case. But yes, in two of those years, there was a legit deficit which required getting that money from somewhere to make sure that all of the bills were paid at the end of the year.
Yeah, and that was the interdepartmental the enterprise fund basically funded the negative reserve.
Thankfully, Susan just corrected me. So thankfully, it was not an illegal transfer from an enterprise fund.
I didn't say illegal.
I did. So it was likely a transfer from the risk management reserve.
Right.
Which is a separate reserve, as you know, that hangs out there. So which yeah. Actually is a good argument for why that's not a bad thing to have.
Yeah, it was more or less
yeah.
to point out where it shows up on the financial
yes.
reporting, not that anybody's interested.
And actually, just a point on the risk management fund, the city has tapped that fund. They've identified that $500,000 is an adequate reserve, and it was built up to about $2 million several years back. So there has been a practice of using it to cover other needs, both during the Great Recession and for other purposes. Although the focus tonight's on the general fund, just as a side note, the balance in that fund is dropping rapidly enough that you won't be able to continue that practice if you're going to keep the minimum $500,000. And you do need some reserve in there for insurance claims that aren't otherwise covered by insurance. So.
If I could just, because it's been a point of some discussion, so I will likely argue for a strong, a firm hand on the general fund reserve, and to keep a healthy and firm hand on the general fund reserve, and then our risk management reserve is likely fairly significantly more than it needs to be. CJPIA covers most of our risk. And therefore, there actually is some money in that risk management reserve that that could be allocated one time only to other projects. So right now, it's at $500,000. The level is, if that level were $50,000, which is what Pismo, I believe, has, and other cities is more in that area, then there is some one time. Either spending or, if needed, pad to the general fund available to make sure that we mm-hmm. can make it through these 5 years. The main point of this slide, though, was we've had this funky thing going on over some years where we would show a negative balance in the general fund and a positive balance in the emergency reserve. What we want to do going forward is have everything look like the end of year at FY15, where the general fund is out of money, and then everything is in a reserve, and you start over again going forward.
Right. And the other point I want to build on where Dave was talking about reexamining the risk management fund and its need for a $500,000 reserve, probably in the same process, you want to take a look and see if the justification for the 27.5% reserve is still valid or if there are other factors that might lead to it either being lower or higher. The GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association, has a recommended minimum reserve equal to 2 months of expenditures, which 2/12 is 16.67%. It's kind of a funny number, but a lot of cities maybe round it down to 15%. So that's what a lot of cities these days are going with. But they also say that it's critical that the unique circumstances of each city be considered and that it also be done in the context of a long-range plan, which you have. So by taking that into account and potential economic downturns, that has a big impact on, you know, whether the reserve is going to wind up being adequate. So now, without further ado, this is the forecasted balance. The red line is your desired reserve level in dollars. So that 27.5% times the expenditures, this is where you would want the reserve to be. The blue is where it's been. And again, this is a consolidated cash balance of the general fund and the emergency reserve. So consolidated bottom line. You can see that there were a couple of years here where you did meet the reserve level, and then it drops down, and then it is going to meet or exceed. You know, it's back to meeting in 2015. It should exceed it over the next couple of years. The balance is, however, going to exceed where the balance winds up being in these outlying years. The reserve goal is up here at a little over $2 million, and the consolidated balance will drop below that in 2018, continue to drop to 2023. As Dave mentioned earlier, you can see there's a more accelerated pace of decline during the time when the PERS costs are higher, notwithstanding the payment of the side fund. But by the time you get the fire plans side fund paid off, things begin to stabilize a little bit. They still slowly drop. And by the time you get out here, now this says one-fifth. This isn't one-fifth. It's about 40% of the of your goal in that year. So that is the situation then is what you do with resolving this problem. And you can either, as this next slide shows.
Sorry, could you go back one, Bob?
Yeah.
So since we've got the council all in one place, and this doesn't happen all the time, you might want to take a couple of minutes at the end of this and have a discussion on general fund reserve. I've had some discussions with some of you individually, and if you just wanted to have some discussion, don't come to any decisions, don't give any direction, but just so we can hear some of the discussion, just some observations. We have a council resolution that says we must have a minimum of $2.75 million or 27.5% of projected expenditures for the future year. Whichever is higher, right? So there's a floor at 2.75 million, but then there's this multiple of 27.5% of the expenditures for the future year. I will first say that I am very so the difference between 27.5% and the GFOA, whatever they were, 16.67%. That is essentially 2 months of savings versus 3.5 months of savings. I am very comfortable being more in the 3.5 months of savings category than the 2 months of savings. That said, so I don't want you to read my sense here improperly. I think it is wise to have a very healthy reserve, general fund reserve, especially if we're considering reducing the amount in the risk management reserve. That said, that calculation of 27.5% of budgeted expenditures for the future year is a funky calculation. Because first you're guessing how much you're going to be spending in the future year. And then also, if there are any one-time expenditures, for example, if you said spend $500,000 of the Dynegy payment, and you were only going to do it that year, and you never were going to have it again, you would still be required to reserve 27.5% of that. So there might be, I guess the third thing I'd say is, if we have confidence, and I do have confidence in Bob's forecast here, and we've double-checked the PERS thing off of CalPERS, our actuary at CalPERS, so we're very I'm comfortable showing that spike and that drop. But if we're comfortable with that, then because we do see this spike in 5 years, but then it comes back down, there is a certain amount of risk that could be taken that says, you know, over the next 5 years, we can have pretty good certainty that it's going to come down after 5 years because we know that the big chunk of that is our CalPERS pension contribution. But so all that said, there might be some other approaches to have a different calculation that was still a conservative calculation, a risk-averse calculation. But for example, you could have the calculation at 27.5% of the average revenue over the past 3 years. So it's still a healthy 27.5%, but it's based on how much has actually been coming in over years instead of what really hurts, and you'll see as we get into the budget, is this one-time payment stuff of holding back. So as you know, you and we want to spend some money this year on a general pan local coastal plan, an IT assessment, some of those other things, and there's money in the risk management reserve to perhaps do that. But those so if you care to, having some discussion on the calculation for the general fund reserve is not a bad thing to do in our remaining 4 hours.
And you want, I take it you want to come back to that.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate at the end.
That's great. Thanks.
And I should point out here, I just discovered this slide. The reserve looked too low. It got printed at the GFOA standard of 17%, not the 27.5%. So let's switch. The next slide has the proper level. And as you
there
can
you
see, it's higher because it's above the 2.75 minimum. Okay, so this is two ways to look at the reserve goal and how to meet it. One way to meet it is adopt a lower reserve goal. Another way is to improve your net resources. So what this shows is that at the correct 27.5% reserve goal level, the way to meet it in the near term and the long term, although difficulty meeting it in the middle, is come up with $300,000 either in increased resources such as fees or reductions in expense. That will bring you to the point of being in substantial, not total, but substantial compliance with the reserve level. The alternative, doing the lower GFOA goal, obviously sets the target lower. So you would need $150,000 in ongoing resources or cost savings, and that would meet it in every year. So this just gives you an idea, and the model, you can play with this at great length, setting different targets and making particular changes either in increased revenues or costs and seeing what the net impact is. But basically, I just wanted to get across the idea that the reserve goal itself is an issue as well as the resources that you have at your disposal. But otherwise, absent this change, the balance is going to be down here at just under $1 million, which is going to be substantially below what it needs to be.
Bob, if you can go back one slide. Yeah. So look at this slide, but picture the red line up about a half an inch.
Be, yeah.
So that red line is at 17% essentially instead of 27.5%. But what you see is the blue bars keep going down and down and down, right? So that chart is current. That's what it looks like with no changes to our current, to the forecast that Bob has developed, that we've developed, that we can show you on the dashboard here, except that the red line should actually be higher, so we're actually worse off than this looks. Go to the next one. The chart on the left is if we close $300,000 worth of gap, either by increased revenues or decreased expenses or both. And note what you see there is then you still see the blue bar dip, but then you see it recover. Because of those closing that budget deficit, right? So one way to think about it is in the last one you saw a $300,000 budget deficit, which chips away every year at the general fund reserve. And you're in deficit, so you're taking out of savings, and that blue bar keeps going down and down and down, and then it goes negative, and then you're in real trouble. But this chart shows what happens if we take $300,000 worth of action. That could be finding $200,000 in revenue and not spending that $100,000 on a code compliance guy or whatever it is. Or it could be finding $300,000 of revenue, or it could be, or could be no IT, no code compliance, and you know, a fifth of the vehicle expenditures, whatever it is. But that chart is what it looks like if we can close that $300,000 what is an effective budget deficit right now. And you know, in a couple of years, we still got some issues with our blue bars, which is the balance in the general fund reserve. But also, if you look at it, that general fund reserve never goes much below 300 or 3 million. Or another way it says it is, it never goes below the 2.75 million floor that we've set in our reserve policy. So that can inform your future discussion as well on how we get through those years. Because then you'll note when we get to 2022-23. We're back in a position where the general fund reserve is at or above the 27.5% of expenditure calculation that we have right now. John?
And just to note that that also accommodates $8 million in capital improvement money over a 10-year period added into the current budget that didn't exist.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. I just want to reiterate that point. That $300,000 or the $150,000 includes an increase of $8 million over 10 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, just quickly, one of the other areas that we went over was Measure Q, half-cent sales tax. There is a whole budget associated with this. And one of the concerns we had was making sure that that fund also stays solvent over time, and therefore, what constraints, if any, are there on the ability to continue your current level of spending? So the tax is about 82% of the 1% Bradley Burns rate. Bradley Burns is the law that applied to the old 1% local tax that used to be uniform throughout California until people started doing things like Measure Q, which added additional taxes in certain communities. The tax base is a little different. Auto sales are based on residency, so Measure Q, if a Morro Bay resident buys a car in San Luis Obispo, the city gets a Measure Q tax. But the base sales tax, the 1%, goes to San Luis Obispo, not Morro Bay. There it depends on where the cash register is. So with that distinction, there are personnel costs, fire overtime, capital outlay that are charged to that. We see growth in 2015 levels being acceptable to continue in the past. Capital outlay has varied from year to year depending on projects that people want to charge to that fund. It's been anywhere from zero to $485,000 in the past. So just continuing at 2015 levels should work. There's debt service built in for the fire station. That continues. Contracts continue at $450,000 a year, repairs at about $25,000 with some growth. It's very volatile in the past. These contracts have been as low as $57,000 and as high as $1.4 million. So you couldn't spend $1.4 million every year, but you could spend $450,000 in ongoing. So the idea here is to, and there are competing interests because there are a variety of improvements and services that people want to charge to the Measure Q. And so if there can be a group understanding among the various departments that want to tap that fund as to what the outer constraints of that are, it will allow the fund to build up a more or less normal reserve. In the model, it averages about 14%, so that you're not in a position where in any given year you may be out of money. Because with the debt service and some of these other costs, they're ongoing, and you don't want to, and whereas some of the public works street type projects are going to vary from year to year. So you just have to be careful in what you budget to that, because you don't want Measure Q to become another draw in the general fund. If Measure Q runs over and the general fund has to backfill, then you're not going to get the outcome that we saw as a general fund balance. So the last two charts, I'm really not going to go through in detail, but it just summarizes for you the major categories of the general fund in terms of revenues and expense. It shows the amounts trended out through 2023. It shows here that there's a zero balance for the general fund, but right below it is the emergency reserve, and it shows in and out to the emergency reserve and its ending balance. And so essentially the ending balance for the emergency reserve is the consolidated balance here, and you can see what the percent of total expense winds up being. Now, this is for not making any fixes. This is not coming up with $300,000 a year, and it's assuming that you keep the 27.5% target. The slide that's behind it is the vehicle replacement fund, the facility maintenance fund, and Measure Q. And you can see Measure Q accumulates a balance over time so that it's stable. Both facility maintenance and vehicle replacement they zero out, and as a result, the general fund is making a lot of the revenue that's coming in here is what the general fund is giving them in order to keep them, from being in a negative balance. So there again, what the model will do is these relationships are set up so that if you wound up putting too much in vehicle replacement or too much in Measure Q, it would start drawing resources out of the general fund and really out of the emergency reserve, and could ultimately get to the point where it goes tilt. You know, you've got a net negative among all those funds. But by setting up the relationships this way, you can make different assumptions. You can plug in different capital amounts. Dave's going to walk the organization through what the real priorities for that $8 million are. And then you can sit down with the departments on Measure Q and say, this is what we expect to be able to spend over time. And you should be in a position where everything balances out. And if you want to set assumptions for different economic scenarios or different policy decisions, it'll all flow through those key funds. Now, this does not get into your enterprises. That's a separate issue, and we'll be talking about some of that in the main report. But you definitely need to get fees up in those areas because your current budget shows the decline in balances over the last few years. That's not a trend that could continue. So there are some other areas that need to be worked on, but this is sort of your general governmental area. And so the model addresses that, and that's the end of my slides. And so if you have any other questions, I'd be glad to respond.
Thanks for your presentation. So for the sake of maybe some other interest here, so we talked about going through some questions and then public comment. Does anybody feel the need for a break, or do we want to just go through the questions, public comment, and then prior to getting into discussion, we can take a break then? I know there's some. You want to take a break now? Or okay. All right, so let's take a short break, then we'll come back with our questions and public comment. Thanks. Go. Looking for two thumbs up. We're good. Looks like it. Okay, good. Thank you. All right, welcome everybody. We're back from our short break, and we'll move on to council questions following this great presentation. Thanks very much. And start to my right. Anybody want to start off with questions to the right?
Just
for,
a quick question about
questions about this, and then we'll go open up for public comment.
Yeah, about running some alternative modeling. You want to hold that till after?
In the discussion and things?
Till the discussion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have any specific questions that I need answered right now.
John?
Yeah, I do. Looking at the anticipated addition of, and what page they're paginated here, page 12, slide 24, the additional $8.1 million of capital improvement funds that have been added over a period of 10 years. Compared to a city that has gross revenues of 12 or 13, maybe 14 million, how realistic is that in terms of benchmark cities? And I'm going to ask two questions, one to you, sir, Bob, with regard to your experience, and then one to our city manager, David, with regard to the reality of that fund being adequate to do possibly what we need to do. In other words, it seems like that number came from a fairly quick discussion internally of what the needs may well be, but how true is it? So, well, two questions.
Yeah, relative to other cities, you are actually benefited by having one-time or special resources to dedicate. In the facility maintenance fund, the Salwasser loan payments, about $99,000 a year, I believe. That money is prudently being set aside for one-time expenses. So it goes into the facility maintenance fund. And so the general fund isn't the only source for that money. You're having some existing sources. And then you also have the Dynergy payments. And that has either been put into reserve or dedicated to projects in the past. And so you've got some of that money left, although that's not an ongoing source. I think you've seen the last of it. Yeah, okay, done. But the fact that that money exists, most cities don't have any one-time source like that. And so you're a little bit advantaged, and so that's one reason why the $8 million might be as high as it is. Also, a lot of cities that we work with haven't gotten to the point of even identifying what they think their needs are. This is a preliminary look, and I think it can be improved on, but at least you've got something there. A lot of cities have hunkered down into just maintaining the status quo, and they haven't kind of poked their head up to look around and say, we really have these other needs. So they haven't even begun to identify them. So that's what makes comparing cities a little difficult, because in this case, you've at least taken several steps forward, important steps, in identifying needs, and everybody can always do better. But some cities haven't done any of that at all. And so I think that the resources that we project being available will be sufficient to do that. They wouldn't be sufficient to cover, you know, $15 million or $20 million, but they can handle $10 million over that period. So I think the biggest concern you would have as a policymakers is determining how best to allocate that. You know, vehicles are an expensive part of the asset that the city has, and so that's why there's so much wrapped up in that. Plus, so many vehicles haven't been replaced for so long, there's a backlog, and so there's a lot to be done. But that said, some of the other priorities may be higher, and so, you know, I think this internal review will take a look at that.
So on the second part is, I think we've actually discussed in this room before, we have some work to do in identifying capital requirements going forward. My goal for this year is this budget cycle is first, and hopefully by the time you see this, we'll at least have different pots identified clearly. City Hall, Community Center, Firehouse, police station, and have those identify those future those current requirements for O&M and future requirements for recapitalization. At least have those pots identified, and at least start to put some nominal amount into them. And then, I was going to say, hopefully this year. I'll be realistic. Perhaps this year. Hopefully next year. We'll be able to have somebody come in to help us do a real assessment of our capital requirements and say, okay, how much longer is City Hall good for? 40 years. But it's going to need a 20-year replacement in that period, and to do that math and then identify how much we need to be putting into the City Hall bucket every year to get us to that point, and do that for each of the different buckets. So we're not going to be there for this budget cycle. I'm hopeful that maybe for the next one we'll be able to do that. But So I think this is a good first step to say, hey, there's $8 million of investment on unmet needs. And then to, over the next year or two, really fine-tune that and identify, are they going to the right pots? Is this the right number? So I don't know at all if this is the right number for Morro Bay right now, because we haven't done that level of analysis on what especially our capital requirements are for facilities. When I say facilities, I don't mean infrastructure. I mean more so facilities, the firehouse, the police station, the public works building, the city hall, community center, this building.
Thank you. Then I have a follow-up question for Bob, if I may. I absolutely have no confidence in CalPERS assumptions and or projections for the future, especially with regard to the discount rate. And so, you know, if you look at a lot of, I think, the larger houses are really saying 6% is probably more realistic. And I know we'll have the opportunity to play with that, but you have a financial background. What's your sense with regard to the discount rate?
Well, they're good. I mean, the term of art is de-risking, and they're going to have to de-risk their investments. And their staff has said candidly that you can't have less risk in the system without lowering the discount rate, because that's your ongoing assumed rate of return, and less risky investments simply yield less of a return. You know, it's pretty simple. So I think what they're going to do is, for the next 5 years, they have loaded a heavy burden on people, and it's not an unreasonable decision. I mean, what they're doing is putting the system on a sound financial footing, which arguably should have been done, you know, should have been initiated 10 or 20 years ago. But they're doing it now. It is the right thing. There's new management in a lot of aspects of CalPERS, and so it's a good decision that they're making, but the impact on local agencies is terrible over the next 5 years. Big burden. I mean, you're lucky with the side funds, but a lot of people that aren't, that burden is just going to continue. So what they're going to do is, I think, wait till the phase-in of that, the worst of the burden. And then about every 4 years, they do an analysis from top to bottom of their investment policy. They'll probably try to time any discount rate change to be after the worst of the phase-in of the costs, because they don't want to, I mean, they're getting a lot of pushback from local agencies saying we can't afford this. Yeah, maybe it's a prudent thing to do, but we can't afford it. And it will be just made that much worse if they lower the discount rate. When staff recommended a couple of years ago to reduce it from 7.75 to 7.25, so 0.5%, staff decided to go along with half of it and said they want to revisit it. So they did revisit it after a fashion this year and kind of punted, because they'd had 2 good years of investment returns that have not had a chance to get cranked into the numbers yet, and because they also agreed on all these other changes that push the rates up. So the inside word that we get is that likely they will try to wait 3 or 4 years at least, maybe 5 years or more, before they make a change, and then they'll go ahead and lower it and kind of cross their fingers and hope they have good investment returns in the meantime, because to the extent that they do, that's going to ameliorate the impact when they do have to go ahead and de-risk the system. So your skepticism is probably warranted. Having watched them for a while, they're making better decisions now than they did back in the early 2000s, when they told everybody you were super funded forever and the new higher level of benefits would not have to be paid for, and you know that was just bad information. So things are better now, but the burden is going to be significant for the next few years.
Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I'll just keep going this way before I send it off. I just have a couple questions, Matt. On slide or page number 9, Going back to that, I know we were asking questions as we went, but I'm just looking back at my notes.
Which slide?
It was actually slide 18, but page 9.
Yeah.
And Bob, you made some. This was over the discussion of fees and whatnot. And I guess the one question would be, when we get into modeling, will we be able to adjust fees and see what outcomes are when we go through that exercise?
Yes.
Sure. You know, on a gross basis, that's pretty easy to do. What you really do need to do, as Dave mentioned earlier, state law doesn't let you just use fees as revenue-raising devices, pure and simple. They can't exceed the cost of providing the service.
So sure, but it will give us an idea.
So when you get into the individual areas, not only do you have to make sure that the cost you're proposing isn't greater than the cost of providing the service, but then there are other considerations. A service for low-income seniors, you may not want to have 100% cost recovery. So you need to factor all that in. But if the assumption is, well, let's say that we do get $300,000 of increased fees, what does that do to the system? That's very easy to plug in. And so the devil is in the details as you have somebody come in and assess each individual fee. So in the end, you may not be increasing all of them across the board. There may be selected fees. And the total of that may or may not equal $300,000, but you'll know that in the subsequent review by a fee expert.
And then you made one more comment on that slide about a community development fund, which we don't necessarily have, but other cities do. So can
talk
about that?
I'm not sure I'd recommend it for you because the level of development is pretty low, and I think the volatility from year to year is going to be rather significant.
Yeah.
But as was pointed out with some of your sister cities in the area, that have gone to setting up those funds, they're at 100% cost recovery, which probably means in any given year they're collecting maybe 80% of their costs or 120% of the costs, but over time they probably average out to 100% because there is volatility in development activity from year to year. But I think, you know, most cities strive to recover all of their development costs under the theory that we're not generally talking about low-income situations there. Excuse me.
If I could just correct the record, when we were on this slide, I can't remember what three cities I mentioned. I think for some reason I said Paso. It was Atascadero, SLO, and Pismo. I talked to all three of those yesterday, and all three have, by policy, 100% fee recovery in community development.
Okay. Thanks. I think those are all cool. Conclude my questions. Matt, go ahead.
Two questions I have are specifically the $300,000 deficit that we're going to have or project. And when we think about labor costs, do we take into effect because our labor negotiations and cost of those labors over the time span?
Well, what we've taken into account running out of voice, I think. We take into account cost of living increases and COLA increase and an increased contribution for health, both equal to 2%. We don't include any other benefit changes. We do assume continued step increases. So those are the costs that we assume in terms of maybe the cost of the labor negotiations themselves, if that was where you were headed with your... Okay, so you were just talking about what the cost of the outcome
was. Looking at these prices or these costs increasing over time, that 2% that you're saying that they're more or less are going to happen in a general way, that takes into account various contracts we have with our various... employees?
Well, it does. It takes into account the current contracts, which are with safety, I believe. Right? Safety employees runs through 2016.
All of them do.
Yeah, but miscellaneous just through 15, or is it everybody now?
Everybody goes, it was on 2 years.
Okay, so we do take into account the current negotiations. Those will start up again, and where they'll go, we're coming up with an approximation of what may be reasonable given inflation. Maybe not reasonable in terms of a comparison city by city in your labor market, and maybe not, it doesn't take into account what people gave up in the past. So But what we're finding is that quite a few cities have you know, wrung out concessions during their employee negotiations. And so when you do comparisons among cities, some of these other cities, the pay levels are either haven't gone up or they are down. So I would say that there's going to be plenty of pressure on the city and you as in future years on labor costs. If you can keep it within 2%, then that's great. The model will show you what the impact is if you start going higher on a consistent basis. You know, any one year you might go higher, but if you were to on an ongoing basis, even go to 2.5% a year, that would make a big difference because it compounds every year.
Okay, great. Just two quick ones. First one, it's on page 12, slide 24. We're talking about the forecast for CIP items not currently funded. And on the line that we were discussing added service, it starts in year 16.
Right.
So this may be a basic question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So if it's a person, for example, a staff person, mm-hmm. that we added $100,000, then does that get absorbed into 2017? And then do we get another 100? Okay, there,
no.
Or is that just
no,
time?
If you were to make a commitment to an ongoing cost, what this does is say you could come up with $100,000 in cost, and as long as it only grew at 3% a year for these amounts, that's what you'd have. But see, the next year, you're just paying the second year cost of that person you hired in year one. So it isn't any extra money. That's a case where if you make a decision in year one, it's obligated for the duration. Whereas if it were a series of annual $100,000 one-time expenses, you could do 10 things, which may or may not be related. But you're right. When you go in and commit it to a person, unless you're prepared to get rid of that person the next year, it's an ongoing commitment.
Okay, great. And then The second question is kind of a staff question, I think. Thinking about how we utilize this 10-year forecast moving forward, so this year we're doing our one-year budget, but we'd also talked about doing a five-year forecast. Do we now have that built into our system where we do a one-year budget and a five-year forecast, but in this case it's a 10-year forecast? Or how do you envision utilizing this moving forward to hitting that mark where we wanted to get to a two-year budget with a five-year forecast?
The good news is tonight we get to go home and scratch something off our goals and objectives, because we've just given you a five-year budget forecast, which is one of them. And actually, we're going to scratch off twice because it's a 10-year. What I don't know is how we're going to time the, because you're going to get to decide, frankly, the potential of going to two-year budgeting. Joe and I were talking at lunch, both Lompoc and Bellwether, his two other cities, do two-year budgeting. How we time that, but I'm committed to regularly bringing a forecast to at least having one on hand and bringing it in various forms to you. I think it's appropriate to do it every year. And I say in various forms. Some years it could be a deep dive professional look. Some years it could be just internal staff. Some years it could be sort of staff plus. But I'm not sure how we'll do that. But I think this is an important drill for all of us.
Okay. And actually, I'll toss in one comment. From my perspective, comparing a two-year budget to the forecast is far more valuable and important. The thing that often happens with a two-year budget is if there's enough change going on, you have to redo it anyway in year two, so you haven't necessarily saved anything. A true two-year budget will enable departments to save money the first year and carry it over to the second year, so that's an issue that you need to decide what type of two-year budget you want. Is a two-year budget really just two standalone budgets, 2 years glued together, or are they connected in the sense that you can not spend the first year and not be penalized by having it taken away, you know, have it carry over into the second? That makes a two-year budget a little more useful if you go that route. But if you were going to do only one or the other, go with the forecast, because that tells you where you're going. And the forecast now is for the funds that I highlighted, facilities, vehicles, general fund and the reserve. You have other key funds, the risk management and the enterprises, that you could use a similar approach to. And and then ultimately have a 10-year forecast for everybody. But as it stands now, this is a 10-year forecast for your key governmental funds, but it doesn't go into the enterprises yet.
I'm hopeful both are doable, and because we had a discussion a couple council meetings ago. The benefit of a 2-year budget is, as Bob just described, if you do it well, what that means is instead of $300,000 this year for streets and $300,000 next year for streets, of which maybe 25% of that is simply mobilization costs to get all the dang equipment down here, then you put those two together, and in January of the second year, you spend $600,000, and you only pay that mobilization cost once. So there's, you could apply that to IT acquisitions, and many different things where there is a savings in doing it. Sort of, it's like, you know, it's buying in bulk.
Great. And then I just want to make sure that when I was talking about the 2-year process, I was also talking about the goals, to link the goals to the budget, to the forecast, 2, 2, and then 5. Because I think the goals, it's a good idea to look at, if you're looking at the budget in 2 years, and it makes the goal process for 2 years,
yeah.
People can wait for that second year. Okay,
it's
thank you very
much. It's going on here. If you were forcing me to do it right now, it would be 2s and 6s, and it would be attached to the election cycle.
Absolutely, right.
And so we would have a 6-year budget forecast, and then we would have a 2-year set of goals and a 2-year budget, and that would all be tied to the election cycle. So new council would come in, they would go through the budgeting process for 2 years, we would execute that for 2 years.
Let's do it.
And we would look at a 6-year, whatever you call it.
Perfect.
6-year set of goals with 2-year objectives also within those goals.
Correct. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Actually, was that a decision? Because I could cross something else off the list.
Yeah.
That's where I think many of the discussions we've had since I've been on this council, we've been meaning to get to that because it just makes sense. It just follows a political cycle. There are two, every 2 years you've got a new council, and the priorities shift. And it's only fair that the folks who get elected based on the issues of that election for 2 years work on those issues with those priorities. So I would be very happy to agree to your 2-6 plan.
2-2-6.
Doesn't add up to 4, so we should be clear that. But I understand, and I would support that.
Any other discussions? Okay. I think at this point we can, I think we're looking for some affirmative direction from that, Dave. I think you were asking.
Did you want to do public comment first?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I was sort of joking, but
yeah. And that's why I was looking for Joe. So we'll just kind of pause at this point. We'll go for public comment, and then we'll come back for discussion. So I'll open it up for public comment for anybody who'd like to speak at this time. And I'm looking at our one audience member who, thank you for being here, Don. Okay, you're all good to go? Okay. So we'll close public comment. Anybody else? And we'll close for public comment and bring it back to council for discussion. So getting back into discussion, I know you mentioned some well, let's just open it up. And I think I started from the right last time. We'll just start up with Christine on discussion, and we'll just move to the right and then open for discussion. I think one of the items on there was let's have some discussion about the general fund emergency reserve, and one of the other items was the risk management fund.
Would you like us just to show you this model for a minute or two and play with some of the predictive stuff, and that might inform your discussion as well?
Are there any discussion items first? Do we want to just jump into some of the modeling? And I probably would like to jump into a little bit of the discussion on the emergency reserve and risk management fund prior to going to modeling. But is there any other, Christine, did you have
a I just had a few things to mention.
Let's go ahead and
get feedback on from whomever. First thing is just, I was making a list of things as we were going through, so I'm not going to belabor it, but I'm just going to mention it and see what if there's anyone else who thought about it. When we were talking about revenue sources, I think that I wanted to just mention this idea, basically, is that in terms of what we're trying to capture new sources for sales tax in particular, that revenue stream, I think if we just have, and I don't think we have spent a lot of time thinking about how we can here capture the coast. because clearly people are going to drive into San Luis Obispo, but how can we get people from Cambria and Cayucas and Los Osos to come to Morro Bay as an option to going all the way into San Luis or driving to Atascadero or Paso if they're in Cambria? And the reason I mention this is because for years I stood in front of Albertsons and promoted our Friends of the Book Sale, Friends of the Library Book Sale, and I cannot tell you, after doing that for 3 years, four times a year, how many people said, oh no, I'm a member in Cayucas, I'm a member of my library in Cambria, that they're coming to Albertsons. Think about it, right? They have, what are their options? So Los Osos also, I mean, when you spend time over there, it's even, they're even more limited than we are, now perhaps not with grocery stores, but with other things. So just kind of thinking about capturing the coast, that's one thing I wanted to throw out. Lastly, because Cayucas and Cambria also have rather affluent populations, if you look at what their homes cost versus what ours do. And now I know their population's not as full-time as ours, but there's still cash there that flows around in their community. I wanted to mention, too, that when we talked about, when we did decrease development fees a few years ago, I can't see, in talking about our discussion here, where we either had an increase now in TOT revenue or we had a significant increase in our sales tax revenue. So when we did drop all of those development fees a few years ago, and maybe others know exactly what years that they were dropped on, where we just waived everything or certain particular things about community development fees, I can't see that we made significant increases in either of those two revenue streams. So it's just sort of, if we're pointing that out, that there's that idea out there sometimes that if you drop the fees, then you'll get things and they will come to you, but it didn't. I can't see that benefit of that in the budgeting going forward the next 10 years for us. Multi-year MOUs seem to be preferred, and we were in a much better position this year because we have multi-year MOUs with our bargaining units, and it just definitely takes the pressure off when you're looking at your budgeting. So keeping that in mind, that that's something that we know those fixed costs for us pretty much, and that we got to that through using our own internal negotiating, and absolutely we're doing every year, Bob, and that takes a toll on everyone. So it's much better to work to get those in place if you can. A TOT reserve. I will tell you that there was a gentleman on the Tourism Bureau Board who was doing, he's had a background in banking, and he mentioned frequently, because the TOT was doing so well in these boom years, as you've described, I felt as though there was a real desire on the part of folks in tourism to have the city put some of that money in a reserve and to say, this money over budget, how are we going to spend it? I got the feeling that they really did want us to reinvest in our community in a way that made sense. Not that they were trying to tell us what to do with it, but that they really wanted, it seemed to me there was a real desire to set the money aside and say, okay, look, this is a one-time benefit over what the city budgeted that you receive with TOT. So I could see us doing that this year in particular if the overage is going to be significant. I think we do want to think about that because that is appreciating the effort, but also appreciating it as perhaps not forever. So it would be a one-time cost, and we could point to that. I think there's a real belief that that would be a good thing coming from the tourism community.
Can I clarify something? I heard you say TOT reserve, and I also heard you say invest that in the community.
I did.
To me, a TOT reserve is put it in the bank for the year that TOT doesn't come in as high as it was.
Oh, that's
invest in the community is take that TOT reserve and let it build up, and then spend it on something that's some investment.
Well, that would be
which
your,
were you getting?
Well, I think this year, what was the projection? $300,000 above what we have budgeted for TOT? The city's budget figure was about $300,000 less than what we're expecting. Is that, I should be correct on that number.
No, I think it's more like $500,000. Just look it up.
It's going to come in another two.
It was 2.79 versus 2.25, so it's like $540,000.
Significant.
Yeah.
That we did not budget for. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a discussion that we should have during the budget time is I think what I'm advocating for is setting that amount aside, putting it somewhere and saying this money came from TOT this year over what the city's estimates were.
And
whether we choose to keep it in a fund for 2 years or not will be made, by staff recommendation and council approval. But I think making a notation of those funds would be wise. I'm just advocating for that somehow. That we, because when we spend that money, we can simply say these funds came from 1 year, 2 years, 3 years of successful excess TOT. Do you understand? Does anybody else want to chime in?
Yes, I think Susan's reaching for the mic too. This seems more like a balance, kind of a carryover balance from our TOT. Is that what you're talking about, Christine?
Clearly, I am not an economist, so neither am I a bookkeeper. Mm-hmm. So I'm not getting the terms correct here. Okay, but the essence of it, I think, Susan, do you understand?
I know what you're saying. And one of the things that I think you need to take a look at is slide 27. On slide 27, you see all these red numbers where the general fund is. And 14, it's got a 0.8, which $800,000 of the general fund cash was in a negative position. That's one of the things that the excess TOT is allowing us to get general fund cash back to a zero. So while I understand exactly what you're saying, if we could carve that piece off and use it to reinvest, but what we've been doing is letting the general fund recover with it. So it's sort of a double-edged sword. If you carve it off and use it for something else, that number's not going to be zero.
That's perfectly fine as long as we identify it as what we're doing. And I'm not sure, have we done that before, specifically said, okay, now that, exactly.
We're on the same page now.
So just point, okay, okay.
What I heard now is that be able to articulate what you're spending the excess TOT on, the above budget TOT collection.
That was my intention.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And then the last thing I would just say is appreciating where we are, because it isn't quite, I mean, it's not necessarily rosy, but I suppose we're a little further from the edge than we could be, and that is a better feeling. Looking 10 years out, it's not fantastic, but it's better than probably a lot of other people. So with that, I would just close my comments and look forward to having a broader discussion on some of the items that Dave's requested.
I do have two questions or additions, and part of this, if on slide 11, when we talk about the various sales tax by economic sector, one thing, and I think Bob, you were pointing it out in terms of the weak areas, and when we think, and one way that I think that can be improved or thought about and targeted is specifically something like Measure D, north of Beach Street, and improving whether or not if and when we get a haul out a facility, improving our industrial base here in town, and kind of diversifying from a tourist-based economy, although that's going to be us for the long haul, but somehow, and then also, Dave, your LEAP station talking about the fiber optic network, creating more, not necessarily blue-collar, hands-on industrial, but somehow increasing our jobs and somewhat be they computer-based or hands-on industrial work here in the town, and then that could diversify us away from relying so much on TOT. And then also when we come, my next follow-up or addition was talking Pismo Beach being smaller than Morro Bay population, had such a higher number of or a higher level of TOT. One thing that to use that additional TOT money that you're talking about, Christine, is to somehow improve our, not necessarily improve, but market Morro Bay's tourist experience that would then match and get, and I think we talked about it, heads in beds for longer than a single night, if we can start doing what these other towns are doing, 2-3 nights, and that would improve our tourist experience. So two things, improving the industrial base and then somehow, if possible, using TOT monies to increase tourist stays. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. I just wanted to pick up on a little bit on the business industry on the slide 11. You know, I shared some similar thoughts on that as well, Matt. And part of that, I think, the opportunity for the general plan and the local coastal plan update. So as we go through that, you know, are we able to identify, areas of zones for light industry, and we don't even know what light industry means for Moore Bay, and that'll be part of the general plan and local coastal plan update. So I just want to highlight that because clearly we may not be a San Luis Obispo with big box stores, but we may have that niche cottage industry that people are attracted to here, and maybe that fiber optic is one aspect of that, you know, building that into. So, you know, to be diverse, and I think we have the potential to be diverse, other than just solely reliant on the TOT, but it's something that hopefully we'll gain traction on when we develop our general plan and LCP. So I just want to pick up on that, your comments there, Matt, as well. And then echo some of the comments as far as the 2, 2, and 6. I just want to confirm that as well. And then, but what I did want to just circle back to on the TOT reserve comment, I just want to make sure that we understand that, and I think maybe John, I might have had some questions on this as well, but just so we understand that, we're more looking for a balanced number. If we have above projections, then how does that balance out on our sheet at the end of the year? I think that's kind of what we were looking for, and then of course how that's allocated out and identified. At least that's what I got out of that conversation. So I just want to make sure I was clear on that, and I'll reserve some of my other discussion when we come back. I think we're going to talk a little bit about more the general fund emergency reserve and the risk management fund, and I think, you know, just a note on that, and some of my research on that, Pismo Beach was one I identified that basically called out their risk management fund at $50,000, and not a lot of cities do have the risk management fund in many cases. Interestingly, on their general fund emergency reserve, they passed a resolution to go from 20% to 25%. So they were at 20%, and their resolution says, "Hey, every year we're going to increase that 1% until we hit 25%." So for the one suggestion here that, you know, you have 2 months worth of savings, they were at 20% and felt that was comfortable to some level, and then they said, "Hey, let's revisit that. Let's go to 25%." So, you know, I just wanted to point that out as a conversation piece if there's further discussion as far as general fund emergency reserve, you know, after some of these other comments. So with that, I'll turn it over to John and Noah. John?
Thank you. First, I wanted to say thank you to Management Partners for an excellent report, very comprehensive, I think very easy to understand, and something that will be useful for the community in terms of telling the story of where we are from a financial standpoint. And I want to call that out as an absolutely imperative issue, that this get communicated as widely as possible to the public, our public, so that there is an understanding of needs to improve economically and the challenges that we have ahead, and really identify those as best we can. And I think this is a good job of beginning that, and I think staff will be able to distill it down to make it even more appropriate for that kind of presentation. And two, I want to thank not only the city manager, but also for the department heads and staff for their input and involvement in this process, because from what I'm hearing, there was significant amounts of input, greater than possibly the past, and I think that's very important to have them on board and part of that process, not only for input, but for future implementation to own it. So some general comments. One, I think we've identified, and what I pick up from all this is a significant need to diversify our economy. We cannot depend upon the three major drivers that we have in the past. I think we can play with the scenario planning, and that would be neat to do, and we'll show some nice increases in numbers, but that there's a significant need to do that, and that is diversify this economy. Two, I think that 100% cost recovery is mandatory, and I think that's been identified as a need across the board. Not only have we previously mentioned that the enterprises need to stand on their own, but now we have identified a need for cost recovery close to 100%, I should say, in those areas where they have not been close to 100%, because the opportunity cost lost over the last 10, 15 years is, in my mind, huge and very, very significant. And we could have been in much better condition overall if we had implemented that some time ago. Third, I think it points out the need to, and I think Christine was alluding to this, to really take a look at our sales tax and try to gain an understanding of how we can improve that specific revenue through either improving the quality of product that we sell, and or, again, I'll use the word diversifying, the type of product that we might be able to make available to a broader geography than just Morro Bay. And I do believe our outlying area is a bigger draw than just Morro Bay itself. And then, for myself, I think I understood, I felt I understood what Christine was saying also about the TOT tax. And with that, not creating a separate reserve, but understanding that we are significantly above budget, that flows directly into the general fund. Those are general fund dollars that will be spent. But making notice or giving notice that that is, you know, a significant addition this year to our fund. With regard to expenses, I think we're getting closer to identifying what I would consider to be salient needs. However, I have this tension regarding, obviously, one, CalPERS and their assumptions, and I mentioned that and talked about that during my question time. Two, the assumption on the health care cost for this county, one of the highest in the state. And we probably are underestimating that, and I think that's going to be a big hit in the future and will continue to increase over the next 10 years, et cetera. I think that our goals with regard to our funds that we've set aside, risk management fund, the reserve fund, and the general fund, I think I would agree with what the mayor said with regard to really taking a hard look at the risk management fund, really determining if there is a need for that or paring that down significantly. And whether we get there tonight or not, I'm not sure. And then, you know, the capital budget, I think it's a great start that we've got $8 million over 10 years, but I do think it's probably 10 drops in a bucket. I was going to say a drop in a bucket, but it's probably 10 drops in the bucket. And I really want to allow staff more time to really identify, in conjunction with the great list of goals that we have, some costs that will be associated with that to gain efficiencies, to improve operations, and to get us to a point where we're actually able to save dollars because we are using our equipment, hopefully new equipment, effectively and efficiently to realize the outcomes that we need to realize as a functioning city. So that number I'm a little uncomfortable with right now, and I know that you've done some beginning work, but I think that's going to end up a lot higher and may impact our discussion on the goal itself with regard to the reserve. And I think it's extremely important to have a well-identified capital budget. And my last comment has to do with the number of years of budgeting and the cycle for budget. I'm not opposed to a two-year budget. I think it's certainly fine to have that However, that's going to be adjusted probably every 6 months as you look at the budget. And so it really doesn't make really matter if you do a two-year budget or a one-year budget. You're looking at it every 6 months. You're going to make adjustments. What I think is more important is a 10-year look that has a solid set of data as we possibly can have, and updating that on a routine basis and keeping that 10-year look each year in front of us. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'll pick up on that because, you know, it's really obvious to see what an effective tool this is going to offer us, and getting in the habit of updating it as we go forward. It's going to inform every decision, actually, when it comes to the finances, and actually when it comes to policy as well. So I think we're really setting a course for Morro Bay just tonight, and with this one item, as Dave, you mentioned, being the top, you know, the forecast out and really start to make decisions in context rather than just that 1 year ahead of us. So I'm really excited about this, and I think it's going to be well worth the investment. I mean, the small money that this has cost us, what it's going to return over the years is just obvious to me, and I think all of us. A couple of quick ones. I do like the general concept of the 226 idea. I think it fits. It respects the election cycle. It also helps respect staff, so we're not second-guessing where an election would take us in the future and what sort of goals would come out of that. So in concept, I think that's good. I'm definitely inclined towards the full fee recovery, particularly in planning. I think there's going to be some more nuances that we need to look at more closely in some of the quality of life type stuff and so forth outside of planning. But that one, to me, is really essential for us going forward. Christine's concept or discussion about the TOT reinvestment, I heard that as more of a balance sheet type approach, not necessarily creating a special fund, as Jamie said. And I did want to mention, though, at one point there was a discussion, which I'm cautious about, of a TOT reinvestment ordinance or something that basically carves out, it's an incentive for new hotel rooms to be created, where if someone's going to build a hotel or expand their hotel, those additional rooms would receive a reduced TOT cost or TOT assessment. And so the city basically is making less TOT on those new rooms, trading that reduced TOT on those rooms for an increased, hopefully, overall room number of rooms available. And it was kind of an interesting idea. This occurred about 3 years ago, I think, the idea. Since we've seen a fair number of investment in our hotels, regardless of that. So in that case, if we had implemented it then, would we have seen more rooms built? I'm not sure. We definitely would have given away some TOT revenue at that point. But I think cautiously considering that might be something to really stimulate a bigger investment in new rooms, or at least updated rooms and expanded existing hotels. Let me move on to with reserves. The risk management fund, I think, is definitely the direction we're going, where we're starting to reduce that down to a more consistent number with other communities. Makes sense to me, knowing that we have the CJPIA backing us up there. My thought with the other emergency reserve is that I would definitely be willing to look at a prior three-year expense average to help level that out and keep it a little more consistent and less fluctuation, because we could really start to have to chase that 27.5% if it is just that 1 year, and that can be problematic. I think, though, because of the TOT volatility, we need to be prepared for a major weather event, natural disaster, or another recession to interrupt what has become our primary or our building towards a primary flow of revenue. So I think that fact alone makes me feel very strongly that our reserve needs to be robust, and I'm willing to try to level it out, our calculation, but I'm going to be advocating that we keep that up as much as possible because of the volatility of TOT alone. One item that, John, you kind of just mentioned a little bit was as we look at capital projects and starting to create a fund and a plan to address these, I've just cringed every year as we look at how much expense is going to be going into just vehicles alone. And I know you're looking at that, and I really appreciate that. And I think knowing how vehicles are changing just in their design, we're going to hybrid, we're going to all sorts of different types of sharing programs and so forth. It seems to me it's a very dynamic time for vehicles, and anything that we can do to reduce our dependency on vehicles is going to save us money and try to increase the efficiency. I'm not expecting a lot of new, very high return ideas, but I would really appreciate if you can, I know you are, double downing on that, because we can see those costs. When you look at those line items, I mean, it's staggering to think what that's going to cost us going forward and how much of our revenue stream is going to be eaten up by that. And we've all heard the comments, see all the new shiny vehicles driving around, and so that should be on our streets or whatever. I know the citizens out there are very sensitive to seeing a lot of new vehicles flying around, and you know, when we're talking about not having many funds to use for other needs. And then just to offer a nice transition point, that financial forecast, as we have it, I understand it's conservative, but I'm cautious about one mild recession in that window. And then I do notice that that kind of sets us up, once we go beyond our existing window, to be ready for another recession. And those are two things we need to keep in mind as we look at this. And I will ask to have, as we play with it, have the forecast show what a larger recession could mean for us, so we're at least acknowledging that there's possibility of that happening.
Okay. Since we kind of cruised through a couple things, and I thought we were going to come back to more conversation on the reserve, but it seems like we all kind of hit on it. The only thing I just wanted to follow up on, Dave, you made some comments on one, as Noah was saying, interested kind of in the average, three-year average. The other thing was 27, the general fund reserve on projections, not expenditures. Was that what you were talking about on that?
So, a couple things. I was sort of thinking out loud, which is dangerous. But I just wanted to give an example, and we can wrestle through with a couple of approaches. What I sort of heard was some, yeah, let's. I heard a little bit of let's think about how we're doing this. So I get a couple of notes, and I think maybe end with that one. So I sort of comment on this. So what Noah just talked about the TOT reinvestment or something, really interesting, actually. Because when you think about attracting business, you'd like to be able to give some, you know, how do you attract, what are the incentives, right? Except for planning fees, our entire incentive can be something like about, well, we can not require you to have a $3,800 business license. That's not an incentive for a 100-room, you know, conference center hotel to come build or something like that. I had thought about, but if you said, we will collect the TOT for your rooms over a three-year period and give that back to you, I don't know if we can do that. But as an incentive or some way to incentivize the first X years of that TOT, you know, if you move your Toyota headquarters from Torrance, California to Austin right now, you get all sorts of taxes forgiven for X years, or, you know, and believe it or not, New York is doing that right now. So that was really interesting. That's something we should, as we're talking about, if there's the opportunity to court some businesses that would significantly change that bar chart and improve our, John, I can't remember how you phrase it regularly, but improve the quality of product or so that's one thing. The second is this right here is a great example of why 27.5% of projected expenditures is a concern. So this is the year we built the Harbor Walk, the roundabout, and the fire station apparatus bay. That's what drove that up, is one-time spending on those things. So as you went into this year, so let's put that in today's year. Let's say that there was a $500,000 pot of Dynegy money, and we said we want to spend that this year on general plan, on IT, and on something else, and then it's not going to be available any other years. Based on our current situation, the first thing we would have to do is take $138,000 of that $137,500 out and stick it in the emergency reserve just for this year, and then it would be available next year. Not sure that makes a lot of that's the best way to approach, especially for this year coming up. So I think there's whether it is an average of the last 3 years of revenue or of expenses or some way measuring it, then that is something that we should certainly consider. And then I'll turn it over to you. The last thing I'd say is because I just want to hear Bob. I want you to hear Bob confirm this because it makes me way uncomfortable. But what this shows is, and this is not all bad here, right? This is a concern right in here that our general fund reserve is below the 27.5%. And this is if we close the $300,000 budget deficit, right? So we've closed the $300,000 deficit. You've taken some action to say, okay, we're comfortable with this right here because it's almost $3 million bucks anyway. What this still shows is, notice this blue bar goes down for 3 years. That means deficit spending. And so I would generally be very, very reticent to bring to you an unbalanced budget that says we're going to be doing deficit spending. But I just want that's what that means, right?
Yeah.
And so if there is a 10-year budget forecast that says we are doing this for a specific reason for a specific time, then although it will hurt me and Susan even more, I could see bringing to you a deficit that was mildly out of balance, like from there to there, because it's part of a 10-year plan.
Okay. So one other question back on there as far as the general fund emergency reserve for the expenditures, because Bob, you mentioned something about that too. Most cities have the general fund or the emergency reserve in the general fund. So when we're talking about, and I didn't quite catch all that, but maybe you can elaborate, but when you talk about based on expenditures, the other thing that is recommended that we have basically 2 months worth of operating and maintenance revenue on our emergency reserve. So as an example, if we were doing capital projects, would we stop a capital project and ensure that we had the emergency reserves just to be doing our operation and maintenance? Is that kind of what you were alluding to, Bob? I was just wanted.
Well, most cities consolidate. I mean, the general fund holds its own reserve. I mean, it's not essential you do that. As long as you've got the relationship defined between the two, you just don't want a situation where the general fund continues to run deficits and you have what looks like a nice balance in your emergency reserve, but you really have to net the two together in order to know what you are truly dealing with. So I think the main thing is to just make sure that you don't let the general fund run negative balance. The 27.5% level is in excess of the 2 months operating expense. Now, introducing capital projects kind of messes that up a little bit. Dave was saying that that peak in the past does get generated by having capital projects flowing through the general fund. Some cities don't run capital projects through their general fund at all, so you don't get that kind of distortion effect. But and the main thing, I think typically when you do have a capital project that the general fund is fronting the money for, it does get reimbursed. So it's partly the timing, you know, Susan, in terms of how this all comes about, but you could run capital projects through a capital project fund and not through the general fund. And if the general fund's expected to make a contribution, you do that, and as long as it's incorporated into the forecast, you know, you're okay. Like Dave says, you could have a couple of year period where you don't meet the goal, but if it's in the context of a plan, and again with transparent assumptions, you know what you're assuming and people are okay with that, then that's okay. That's part of the plan. I mean, one of the reasons why it dips in there also is because of the proposed recession and the whole idea of having an adequate reserve is to weather the recession.
Sure.
And you do. So, you know, you can check that one off the list. If the recession isn't any bigger than it is, I mean, there was a comment about trying alternative recession, and that's part of what you should do with a model is test all of these assumptions. What if PERS return is less? What if the recession is bigger? What if the TOT grows at a different amount? And you, COLAs are bigger. You can plug all those in. And as long as within some reasonable disparity of the assumptions, you're still in good shape, then it may not matter whether you're at 27.5 or whether you levelize your target or whether you're at 16, you know, because the long-term plan is what shows you that you're okay.
Good. John?
Yeah, you know, the private sector has something called funded depreciation that is your capital budget. And, you know, that's absent in the public sector. And so in the absence of that, often the, at least in my understanding, the reserve becomes, in essence, a comfort level of being able to fund a capital budget and have money set aside for that rainy day, so to speak. And I wouldn't be comfortable, obviously, right now, tonight, saying it should be this number or this percent or what have you, because I think it's going to take some time to go through this for us to think about it,
yeah.
Et cetera. But I do think it's important to have a good understanding of capital spending as clearly as we possibly can, because it has been absent for a significant amount of time in this enterprise. And two, we know we can mess with a number of these sensitivity analysis alternatives, but what if two or three of them happen at one time? Then, you know, we're really in trouble. And so I want to make sure that in essence, that I would err on the side of conservatism in having excessive funds that could be utilized as an example for, and this isn't to point fingers at anybody, but we had an issue that came up with regard to not having budgeted amounts for the MOU that occurred this year for labor. That was significant. And in addition to that, there was a construction issue that was fairly large. Add those two together, and if we didn't have that significant fund, we would have been in trouble. So, thanks.
Okay. Any other discussion? You want to get into the modeling?
Sure.
Let's just put it up there so you can see that
sure.
It's there. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it. And in fact, so almost maybe we shouldn't. But let's just show you something, because what you're going to see is this is the chart that I'm sort of leaning toward, just so you know, but this is a council discussion going forward. But remember, this one requires closing $300,000 worth of a budget gap right now, but still leaves a budget deficit for a couple of years. Go ahead, Bob. So this is a tool that Bob created in high school on a TRS-80. Did they have TRS-80s when you were in high school? that we've got, I've got it on my iPhone now. That's what I do when I lay in bed at night. Here is current. So you'll recognize this chart based on the assumptions and projections that Bob just laid out for us, which we can based on the labor cost increases, the PERS pension increases, the $8 million over 10 years of investment in either infrastructure maintenance or technology. But as we talked earlier, the problem is we're in deficit spending for a long period of time, and thus this blue general fund line continues, or boxes continue to go down until they go below zero, perhaps. And doesn't matter what you do with this reserve level line, because you ain't getting close to it. It's bad. So messing around with that line. But so down here is some of the scenarios. Do we plug in a recession? Yes. The recession starts in 2017, so Bob could move that to 2016. He could make the recession, instead of a 5% recession, so there it is in 2016, change a little bit. Make it a 10%. Make it a 10% recession. So as John was just saying, what happens if three of these things happen at the same time? Okay,
even though you have a recovery period after the recession, it's down low enough that it drags you down. So that was one question.
Bob, put 5% 17 back in there if you would, because this is, I think, showing what happens when you close that budget deficit a little bit is significant. So now we're back to where we were, are we?
Yeah, that's back.
Okay, now what if we recovered $300,000 in fees that we're not currently recovering?
Yeah. So that's where it brings you back substantially to the...
And I bet you if you put in enough... Actually, it's on your two slides. It's the left-hand slide here. It's slide the top left of 29 and all of 28. But... Oh, wait, you changed them. Okay, so put 0.3 in there. This is reasonably realistic, not a risky, sustainable approach, which says, okay, we're not going to meet our 27.5% for something happened because this used to touch. I'm not sure what happened.
But
now just take that and put the 10% recession on there, Bob. So now we've closed our budget deficit, and now it doesn't look nearly as bad, right? And it shows that because we closed that $300,000 deficit, now if there's a 10% recession, we never go below $2 million in our general fund reserve.
If development is still happening.
That's true. But I guess what I'm getting at is closing that $300,000 is important, whether it is by revenue or by cutting spending. But that's the first thing we should be worried about, is closing that gap, not what the reserve level is or how big the recession is going to be. Let's get our spending in order first and our revenue in order, and then worry about some of those other things.
But if you have a situation where, say, COLAs are 3% instead of 2%, that takes you down to or even if you have 2%.
Sorry, fix the recession if you would, because that, just we're only thinking about one crisis at a time.
So if you had, let's say, instead of 100,000 a year as the allowance for new services, even if you just do 200, that goes down some.
That's what happens if you hire two employees or one employee and have $100,000 a year of spending on, let's just say, plans. You could do general plan, specific plan, designs, all that stuff. Lord knows we have enough of that stuff that needs to happen.
But even if it's
decided to go for three positions and you had 2.5% COLAs, you know, then you're in a situation that looks pretty much like the original one. So even though you've done fees...
Bob, can you pick up the mic as you're doing that, please?
Yeah.
That would help, thanks.
Even though you added here $350,000 of fees, if you were spending for three new positions and you had 2.5% COLAs, you're kind of back where you started from.
So that's probably good for now, unless you all want to dive deep. But this has been great. I wanted you to see that because Susan
it's
has
good
it.
For everybody else watching to see.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. Susan and I have it. Happy to go through. I mean, happy for you to have it. We can put this out on the website and people can access it. I don't know. I need to be careful about that, but. Absolutely, yeah. So this is a great tool for, and we can do sort of predictive analysis, and as we go through the budget process, do some modeling and say, okay, you know, and frankly, as we go through the year and
John,
see.
John had a question about the PERS. If the investment rate went from 7.5% down to 6%, it would drop 1.5%. So you can cue that in, and based on what CalPERS has given cities as this, their sensitivity analysis, if their rate of return is different, that's the outcome. It's pretty
wow.
significantly bad. And that's the reason is because 70% of the income that CalPERS gets comes from investments. And so it's real top-heavy. If they don't do well on investments, they have to make up all of that in the remaining sort of 30%, which means rates really go up high. And so that's the whole point. Now, that would be year after year after year that happened. And so it's more likely to happen in 1 year. And they might go negative in 1 year, and then a couple of years later be double-digit growth again. So... But, again, it lets you test quite a few different assumptions.
One other thing, out of curiosity, I think it was, if I remember,
there was an ability to add 500 residents to the city.
At this point,
we don't have a baseline
forecast yet from staff. Once we get that, we can make changes to it. But this is based on just a trending... Based on current growth, starting from what the county projects right now, so I don't have that in yet.
Okay.
Thanks. Unless there's any other discussion, this was a great presentation. Any closing comments from council, other than thanks for hanging in there, everybody from staff coming out and participating in this and putting all this together. Very, very cool. Bob, thank you for your work. Anybody else from council? You're all good. Yeah. Dave, anything else? We're good to go.
That's it. Thank you.
We call meeting adjourned. Thank you.